Messages from the House.
February the 25th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Third reading passed. Mr. President, the bills listed below pass the House on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 9, State Engineer Permit Application. Ayes 53, noes 6, excused 1. Senate File 23, Accelerated Nursing Degree Loan Repayment Program. Ayes 59, excused 1. Senate File 115, Investment of State Funds Revision. Ayes 59, excused 1. February 25th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Message number 412, concurrence failed. Mr. President, House Bill number 287, Helium Property Tax. The House failed to concur on Senate amendments to the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 25, noes 34, excused 1. The House requests the Senate appoint a conference committee number 1 to meet with a like committee from the House to report recommended amendments to the bill for final consideration by both houses. February the 25th, 2009, House of Representatives, message number 406, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 13, Shed Antler Collection. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 40, noes 19, excused 1. Message number 408. Concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 37, Antifreeze and Petroleum Products. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Message number 409, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 57, Rental Vehicles. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 58, noes 1, excused 1. Message number 411, concurrence requested. Mr. President, Senate File 144, Property Tax Assessment Rules. The Senate file listed above passed on third reading in an amended form as follows by the vote indicated. Ayes 47, noes 12, excused 1. The House respectfully asks the Senate to concur by adopting the listed amendments. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Considerations of bills in general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that order of business. Considerations of bills in general file.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. First bill for our consideration is House Bill 231. Will the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 231, sponsored by Representative Harvey. Motor vehicle accident, serious bodily injury or death, and act relating to motor vehicles. It was referred to Committee number 1, Judiciary. Report back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Sessions. No, Senator Perkins. Conflict, Senator Ross. Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Mr. Vice President?
Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on House Bill 231. There is a standing committee amendment, and it has to be read in at this time.
House Bill 231, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to engross copy, page 2, line 11.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ross.
I move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 231, and I would yield the floor to the sponsor of the bill, Senator Peterson.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Quick explanation, Mr. Chairman, of this bill. It's come about from an accident that we had in our area. Many of fellow senators, you've had similar accidents in your area where serious bodily injury or death was a result. Being it was an accident or not, how it was charged, we basically what happened in this particular case was that the bond was paid through the mail. No court appearance was insisted upon, and this accident resulted in a death. And so the parents came to the good representative in my district and myself, and we had meetings with the judges and the officers that were on site, and came to this conclusion that this bill was a necessity to help us in the efforts to bring more accountability to these accidents, and besides just a $60 fine that you can pay through the mail. Considering the situation, there's a lot of things that we need to consider as we look at this bill. One is the accountability. My concern was making sure that the person that caused the accident, whether it was their fault or not, the accident was caused, needed to appear before a judge. Just for the purpose of perhaps a physical being required, perhaps the person passed out at the wheel, came to and overcorrected and caused a head-on collision. For any of the above reasons, a judge, an appearance in a court, I felt was a necessity that wasn't being addressed the way the statutes read now. And so as we look at the bill, on page 2, with the amendment on line 11, the driver may be subject to the following penalties in addition to any other penalties prescribed by law. For the first conviction, be punished by a fine of not more than $500 or by imprisonment for not more than 6 months or both. And again, this is may. We leave it to the discretion of the judge. Romanette 2, for a second or subsequent conviction resulting in serious bodily injury within 1 year, therefore being be punished by a fine of not more than $1,000 or by imprisonment for not more than 1 year or both. Again, may, leaving it to the discretion of the judge. The important thing, Mr. Chairman and fellow senators, is the court appearance. In this particular case, the parents read in the local paper, in the legal notices, where the person that had to pay this fine that caused the accident was noted to have paid the $60 fine through the mail. And just above that, a local doctor was fined and punished for poaching, I think it was bear, or not bear cubs, cubs, cougar cubs. The fine was pretty stiff. It was in the thousands of dollars. And as a parent who had just lost a son, reading that legal notice, quite frankly, it offended them. It offended them. They felt that wildlife was worth more than their son. And so the meeting was held, and we came up with this bill. And we're asking, Mr. Chairman and fellow senators, for your favorable consideration, and I would move House Bill 231, and we've already read in that amendment, have we not, Mr. Chairman? There is another amendment, and we could go ahead and read that in at this time. Okay. I would ask for the body's favorable consideration. We stand for any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on House Bill 231, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The amendment has passed. We're on the Committee of the Whole Amendment number one. Would the clerk please read the amendment?
House Bill 231, Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, to engross copy, page 2, line 8.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would move Committee of the Whole Amendment number one to House Bill 231 and ask that we dispense with further reading of the amendment. The testimony in committee was, Mr. Chairman, is very moving. This family did lose a son, and ultimately it seems inherently just and appropriate that in the event that you're in a traffic accident that causes a serious bodily injury or death, that you should at least have to make an appearance. And ultimately what you have, when you look through the statutes, you have a whole plethora of traffic violations, Mr. Chairman, that range from everything from things that are very bad, reckless driving, to things that are just a moment of inattention. Almost any condition that you have, if you lose control of your vehicle on black ice or whatever, it's driving too fast for conditions, and you're oftentimes cited with that. So it's everything from driving with your lights off to maybe not having a taillight out to reckless driving that this bill affects. And certainly it seems appropriate that in the event that you're cited, that you should have to do more than simply mail in your $60 fine, if that's what it is. What the amendment does to this bill is, I was very concerned that ultimately you end up with a traffic accident being a situation where you're ultimately, instead of being about the traffic accident, now results that the traffic ticket, there's got to be determination that the moving violation, that the death or serious bodily injury was the direct result of the conduct constituting the moving violation. And so you end up with a hearing or a trial about a broken taillight potentially being one that determines that the broken taillight was a direct result of the death or bodily injury. That has significant ramifications. That has significant ramifications in the event that there's a subsequent lawsuit or other claims out there. My guess is you present those defenses at the traffic court. And if you're found in the traffic court to be that was a cause of the death or bodily injury, that ultimately that's where you are and that's where you're stuck, and there won't have been the discovery mechanisms and the other defensive mechanisms. So I was very alarmed about that. So what this amendment does, Mr. Chairman, is it goes in and it leaves intact lines on page 2, lines 1 through 7. Actually, lines 1 through 8, and then when you see right there, if a driver is convicted of the moving violation, comma, except a conviction under WS 315-233H, which is a DUI statute, then you would have this new language. The court may, in addition to imposing any other penalty pursuant to law, impose an additional fine of not more than $1,000. So what this amendment would do is take this bill, you still have to appear in person. And in addition to whatever your schedule fine is, and your schedule fine is anything that can run from $60 or $60 up to a couple hundred, depending on how fast you were driving, that in addition, you must still appear in person, and the judge can fine you an additional amount. And ultimately, you have the opportunity to go in there and not have to, you still have to appear and recognize the seriousness of what you've done, be subject to a substantial a civil penalty or fine, but you haven't necessarily determined all the issues that would result in your defense or in the prosecution of a civil case against you. That's what the amendment does, and I believe it makes the bill, I think it addresses the concerns. The main concerns were brought out is that you ought to have to appear. You shouldn't be able to mail it in, and you still have to do that. So I'd ask for your favorable consideration on Committee of the Whole Amendment number one.
Questions on the amendment? All those in favor of the Committee of the Whole Amendment number one on House Bill 231, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Back on the bill. Any questions on the bill? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a question on this bill
and I'm wondering about unintended consequences here. It seems to me that, and I hope to get the attention of the attorneys in the body, it seems to me that I remember that when you have two offenses with similar elements, and you have a lesser offense and a more serious offense, the rule is it's the lesser one that applies. And I may be wrong about that, but does this in any way interfere with the ability to prosecute under 62106, homicide by vehicle, where you've got a subsection A that's a $2,000 one-year offense, a subsection B aggravated, may be punished by more than 20 years? Is in a circumstance where they could charge either this or that, are we precluding them in any way from dealing with the more serious offense? That's my first question. The second question, and I will confess to the Senate, I'm out of my legal depth on that one, as to whether this is going to in any way interfere with that. The second question I've got is, suppose the person that got the serious bodily injury was the driver that committed the traffic offense, been in an accident that caused a serious bodily injury himself. Is he still going to be charged with this and have to appear in court once he recovers well enough to do it? Are we reaching that?
Senator Nicholas?
Mr. Chairman, I guess I concur with a lot of, the questions that are almost rhetorical asked by the tall senator from Casper. When you look to try to figure out what the elements of this or whether or not we're creating a new crime and what the elements are, the first paragraph, line 2-7, is simply saying you have to make it a personal appearance. And then the new crime, if the driver is convicted of the moving violation where the serious bodily injury is involved, you apparently have another crime. And it is true that would be what you might call a lesser included offense. So you have the big offense that you're driving outrageously or whatever it is, a negligent homicide. And I suppose the defense lawyer said, well, I want to put this up to the jury and let the jury convict under this one because it includes all the, this is really what I think involves. But going even more beyond that, I have had cousins, I lost a husband who was out unloading well casing, and another company officer or official is running a backhoe, picks up the well casing, didn't have any training, slipped, pulled the wrong lever, dumped the well casing on top of her husband, and unfortunately it resulted in a death. Tragic thing. Very tragic. So you had a serious bodily injury resulting in death in a work-related injury, and we don't require that person to come in to court just because there was a serious bodily injury to explain to somebody. You might in a civil action, but not in a criminal action. And when you say a driver of a vehicle, and the only fact is you had some moving violation and there's a resulting serious deadly injury. We had a very unfortunate incident in Laramie where a young man's fiddling with the radio, not paying attention, hits a bicyclist, and tragic results and long-term consequence to the bicycle driver or rider, and yet the underlying offense was inattention. It wasn't alcohol-related. It wasn't malicious. And believe me, that young driver suffers from this every day. The family that had the accident suffers every day. But that in itself is not a crime. It doesn't make it a crime simply because there was a bad consequences. Sometimes unfortunate things, negligence, inattention, have bad consequences. you're driving through the state, and you're driving on a snowy, icy road. You're an Oregonian. You hit it. You probably drive a little fast, or maybe you just don't know how to drive on snow. You hit somebody else. Bad consequence. Are you going to require that person to come all the way back from Oregon to attend to a hearing because there's a bad consequence? That is not what the process is for. You go to court. Your first one is, do you come in and you plead. Are you guilty or not guilty? Do you understand your rights? Do you want it? Or actually, the first one, this is what you're being charged with. Do you understand what you're being charged with? And if you come back, you can plead guilty if you don't want to do the trial. If you do the trial, you get a trial and you go through. That's the process. And it doesn't necessarily change because there's unfortunate consequences. It's the notion we call scienter is what generates the level of fault, and that is what was involved in your action that caused the injury, not the resulting injury. Not the resulting injury. And I understand that families need closure, things like that, but the criminal process isn't designed, it often does not give you the kind of closures, even if that would give you closure. So I have a concern with respect to what is the crime. And if the crime is simply that you had a moving violation and a serious bodily injury, those two things in themselves do not create a new crime.
Vice President Ross.
Mr. Chairman, when the bill was reported out, you would probably have heard that I declared a conflict with the bill. I did so for a very valid reason in my mind, and that is that in my law practice, I represent a lot of companies, trucking companies, and companies that, one particular company that does a lot of postal kinds of work and drives around in brown trucks. And I felt that the language that was extracted in the by the Committee of the Whole amendment was problematic to my clients, because you would be ultimately collaterally estopped from proving whether or not failure to maintain a single lane of traffic or something was the actual cause of the injury. Could be multiple causes. The other party could have been actually at fault because they failed to stop at the stop sign or whatever. Well, I think that that's gone now, at least with that language gone. I don't know that I have the conflict that I had before, but I wanted to answer the good senator's question with regards to 6-2-106. 6-2-106 is homicide by vehicle, but the driver has to have driven in a criminally negligent manner. Then you have to go back and you have to find out what criminal negligence is. And criminal negligence in that situation is a gross deviation from the standard of care. So it's more than just being inattentive or negligent. And so that statute wasn't available to these poor people of Senator Peterson's district that lost their son. They couldn't prove that gross kind of conduct. It's a difficult situation because you'd like to have we try to address their pain and their grief, and I think it would be appropriate in certain circumstances. I hadn't thought about what if you're from out of state or whatnot. Do you make them come back to appear for the citation? Maybe that's a public policy that we want them to have. And then the question would be, should it be a heightened penalty? Those are policy questions that we'll have to decide. I think with the Committee of the Whole amendment, the bill is in much better shape than it was coming onto the floor, but hopefully I've answered those questions.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, the philosophy, the idea behind this bill is to first, it was to bring some accountability. Accident or not, we are accountable for our actions, and when we're driving a vehicle, we have responsibility. Whatever caused the accident, changing a CD, looking at the clock, putting on makeup, reading a paper, whatever the case may be, the results a lot of times are the same. A serious accident occurs. And in this case, where bodily injury or death occurred, all we're asking is for enforcement of that accountability, taking upon themselves the responsibility, appearing before a judge, having a court appearance, to do two things, to issue corrective measures. Without this bill, the problem is not corrected. Perhaps there's a health concern. Is this the first offense, the second offense, the third offense? Who knows? And the fourth thing was that some type of closure needs to happen, not just for the victim or the victim's family, but also for the person who caused the accident. Without this court appearance, I don't think there's any full closure to those accidents that happen. If I lived in Nebraska or another state and I had to go back to meet the family in a court to apologize for my actions, to pay the fine, it would help me as the person who caused that accident with some type of a closure, if that's at all possible. As a victim or a victim's family, that would certainly help in my closure of losing a son or a daughter or experiencing some bodily injury. So again, it's a good bill. I think it addresses the problem and helps supply a solution. And I would ask your favorable consideration on this bill.
Additional comments on the bill? All those in favor of House Bill 231, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
No.
Would the ayes please stand? Would the noes please stand? Pursuant to SR 1115, having failed a standing division roll call is required. Will the chief clerk call the roll on House Bill 231?
Anderson?
No.
Bebout?
No.
Burns?
No.
Case?
No.
Coe?
No.
Cooper?
No.
DeCaria?
No.
Dockstader?
No.
Esquibel?
No.
Geis? Hastert excused. Honeycutt?
No.
Jennings?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Landon?
No.
Larson? Martin?
Aye.
Massey?
No.
Meyer?
Aye.
Nicholas?
No.
Perkins?
Aye.
Peterson?
Aye.
Ross?
No.
Schiffer?
No.
Scott?
No.
Sessions?
Aye.
Townsend?
Aye.
Basie?
Aye.
Von Flatern?
Aye.
President Hines?
No.
Closing vote? Closing. Vote closed. 12 ayes, 15 noes, 3 excused.
House Bill 231, having failed a roll call vote pursuant to SR 11-5A, is deemed indefinitely postponed. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 279. Would the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 279, sponsored by Representative Thrun. Statements of Consideration Review, an act relating to property. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election and Political Subdivision, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Cooper, Hastert, Johnson, and Scott. No, Senator Case. Senator Case, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on 279. There are no standing committee amendments, and I yield to the bill's co-sponsor, Senator Perkins.
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What you have before you with House Bill 279 is one of the three that are kind of, if you would, the three of them comprise kind of a taxpayer's rights package in property tax disputes or property tax appeals. The issue that we have before you is ultimately when you have a property tax appeal, or you receive your property tax, and you've got the opportunity to protest your property tax assessment to the assessor and to the Board of County Commissioners, or under some properties directly to the State Board of Equalization, that you go in there and you have the ability then to present certain information about the value of your house and whether it's assessed properly. What the House Bill 279 does is ultimately when it goes in there, you have the right to look at the statements of consideration that are on file but are currently confidential and not available to you. You have the right to look at those statements of consideration for, and it's not just anybody, but you're entitled to review if you go to particularly line 4 on page 2, review those statements of consideration for properties of like use and geographic area available to the county assessor and determine the value of the property at issue. And so what you've got is the assessor's gone, and the assessor has this information. She's looked at it. He or she's looked at it. If you go back and remember how this whole assessment process works, you have the CAMA system. The CAMA system comes out, and then that forms the starting point. From there, then, the assessor will make some professional judgment based upon sales of houses in the area and other like properties and other issues that may come into consideration. The assessor will then make a market adjustment from the CAMA value, either up or down, to achieve what they believe to be the fair market value of your house, and then that is what goes out and becomes, with the appropriate multiplier, becomes the assessed value for your house. What this does then is when that happens and you go in and you want to protest, you have the right to look not only at the statements of consideration that they used, but you have the right to look at other statements of consideration for like properties in your geographic area. And if you look down there on lines 13 and 14, this is where it comes in, Mr. Chairman. The assessor, if you look at that, it includes statements of consideration for properties of like use in geographic area which were available to the assessor and are requested by the person or his agent. So you can look not only at the two or three or four or five properties the assessor looked at, but you have the ability to look at other ones of like in like geographic area of like situated properties. You can look at other ones in the county as well. For this purpose of prosecuting your tax appeal, when you combine this with the other couple of bills that have come through, you now have the ability with bills if they all pass the session, you have bills that will provide the landowner with the opportunity to review how the CAMA system was created and or how the CAMA system the value was created and what went into that. We had a bill here just a little while ago that allowed the Boards of Equalization, the County Board of Commissioners sitting as the Board of Equalization to review and look at any competent evidence. And then with this, the statement of consideration, it finally gives, I think, that final link that you have a decent footing to go in and look at and challenge the presumption of correctness that the assessor has in property tax appeals and to do so in a very meaningful way that provides you the best opportunity to secure your rights in a property tax appeal. And with that explanation, I'd stand for questions and ask for favorable consideration of House Bill 279.
Questions on the bill? President Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my question would be, as I recall, when we passed the Statement of Consideration bill quite a few years ago, the only way it ever got to get into the statutes was the privilege of keeping your private information private. And it appears to me, if I'm interpreting this right, then we're doing away with that. And you can look at anybody's property. Am I misinterpreting it, or is that your intentions?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, and that's a very good question. And that's a concern that came up during discussions on this bill. It's true that currently the statements of consideration in this state are confidential. The two prerequisites for you to look at a statement of consideration under this act are, one, you'll have to file a property tax. You have the right to go in. You've got a property tax appeal, or you had an assessment from the assessor. You want to look at that and review and see if you need to appeal or not. So you would file your petition to appeal, and then you go in, and your ability to look at statements of consideration are limited to properties of like use and geographic area. So you can't come in and say, okay, I've got a little duplex over here in East Laramie County, and so I want to look at the ranch values in Campbell County. I mean, it doesn't go there. I mean, what you're looking at is you have to go in and look at other duplexes that are typed the same in that geographic area, which is going to be relative. Actually, it's going to probably be a smaller subset than even Laramie County, but certainly wouldn't go beyond Laramie County in that example. You're going to be able to look at other duplexes, other similar duplexes, maybe some fourplexes in Laramie County, and you're going to be able to look at the statements of consideration to determine what those values were and how they may apply to show whether you're overpriced or underpriced. But it's not just a carte blanche. It's limited to those areas where you have you're in the process of a tax appeal and only to similar properties. So there is some waiver of that confidentiality, but it is limited.
Additional questions on the bill? All those in favor of House Bill 279, please say aye. Those opposed, nay. House Bill 279 is passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 125. Would the clerk please read the bill?
House Bill number 125, sponsored by Representative Davidson, Establishment of Highways, an act relating to establishment of highways. It was referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, Military Affairs. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Dockstader, Escobel, Geis, Landon, Von Flatern, Senator Von Flatern, Chairman.
For the reading of the bill, what's your pleasure, Senator Von Flatern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the Committee of the Whole rises, I ask that they do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 125, Establishments of Highways, and to explain this bill, Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, fellow senators. This House Bill 125 actually came out of a court case that we had in 2004. In 2004, there was a case with the Board of County Commissioners of Sublette County versus Norton, and I believe Ms. Norton was the Secretary of Interior at the time. Anyway, the case was heard in the federal court here and involved a road going to a private residence on a private property that I believe was established sometime in the 1940s. The road was used by the resident owners on a daily basis and also frequently used by the general public as well as the BLM staff themselves. The homeowners had been maintaining the road for several years on their own, and the BLM was apparently not happy with the fact that they were maintaining this road to their home across a piece of public land. So the BLM began requiring the owners to apply for a permit every time they wanted to repair the road. And since the public also used the road, the repairs were quite frequent. The owners then requested that the county declare it a county road under the RS-2477 federal statute. The BLM refused, and, of course, off the court we went. The judge ruled that because the Wyoming road statutes did not allow for the creation of Wyoming roads unless in strict compliance with 24-1-101 little a, regardless of whether the road was located on public or private land, RS-2477 would not require the federal government to recognize county roads across federal public land. In other words, there was no Wyoming state statute that allows creation of a county road across public lands after 1976. So here we are with this bill to try to correct the problem. The bill expands 24, Wyoming Statute 24-101 little a. The basic change is very narrow and would only allow these roads to be declared, that is by the county, if they go to either a home or an agricultural operation. And it only includes roads that were established before 1976, when the federal statutes were changed under RS-2477 to no longer permit the counties to establish an existing road as a county road. And that is basically what we're doing with this bill, Mr. Chairman, and I stand for any questions.
Questions on the bill? Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have one question. It seems to be rather broadly worded, and perhaps it's not meant that way because I don't understand the context of this statute. But, you know, our public lands have been used for 150 years. And, of course, in the 19th century, there were wagon roads that were established. People had soddies, places of Wyoming, their own homesteads, and they used those as roads. And sometimes they even used them up until the 20s and 30s and 40s. Until the federal government began to establish the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, and places like that. Now there may, for instance, be a wildlife refuge there or a riparian area, or it may even be someone else's pasture that's out there on public lands. Can someone now come along later and say, well, there's a two-track through here, and it was used as a homestead. It's still privately used up the drainage here. 95% of it's on federal lands now, but because it's gone to someone's private home, can they go to the county commissioners and say, make this a county road so that I can use it regardless of what the federal government may have with regard to land management?
Senator Nicholas.
Chairman, and to follow up on what my colleague just talked about, the way I understand this statute, and I think I'd have to go back and look, but it ties in another statute. The issue back in early 1900s was that if you have a ranch, you got roads crossing all over, people are using them, and what the legislature did was said, look, folks, we need to know which are public roads and which are not. And so what we're going to say is that any road that was established prior to this date, if the county commissioners want to declare it a road on this date, they go out and they identify the roads. The first process was one of identification. They simply took a map and they identified these are the roads that we want, and they highlighted them, put them in their journal. The next process, though, was that wasn't good enough, though. If you wanted to have it a public or a private road across a piece of property or make a public road, then they had to publish it, identify it by legal description. So there'd be a legal description published in the newspaper and in the public records, and ultimately they would declare it, go through the process, and if there was a condemnation, they would have to do a condemnation of private property. And at some point, you had a private road created, which was then recorded with the recording clerk, be your county clerk. What that did is, if you have a ranch, then when you go find out you bought a ranch later, and there's five, you pull out your quad map, and they have all these two tracks in here, and the issue is which are public roads and which ones are private roads, you could go back and say, if the commissioners did not go through this process back in the 1920s by identifying the road and declaring it a public road, then it ain't a public road. And so you can claim adverse possession against me, you can claim other things, but you can't complain that it was a county road. Now, I guess we come in now, long after the statute was implemented years ago, and saying, well, if you had a public road, if there was a road that was going across the public land, we're going to say that it's a public road, which I don't know that you can, because in the absence of Congress allowing you to have the road and saying that it is a public road, it's not there. How could the commissioners go back 15 years ago and put the process and declare the time's already gone? So mechanically, I'm not understanding how you even get there, even if you were to expand it.
Senator Cooper.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'll try to answer those questions a little bit if I can. First of all, that's what exactly on the last point that the good senator from Albany County was bringing up there about how you go back and declare it. Well, that's exactly what we're really trying to do with this bill. We're trying to give the commissioners the authority to go back. If a road was established, that it was set before 1976 and it was used before that, then you could go back now and do that. And that's exactly what we're trying to do with this statute. Whether the feds may permit that across certain types of lands, which goes to the other good senator from Albany County's question, is a question in itself, which I doubt would happen, particularly, if we have, like, example, wilderness areas or roadless areas, for example, they are not going to allow the county commissioners to create a new road or an old road even, create it into a highway across a piece of ground that's been established as a wilderness area. First of all, if you go to a wilderness area, there's no problem usually there anyway because there's no houses there generally that I know of. There may be an exception or two, but there's generally not. There's not even any roads in most of those wilderness areas. And in the roadless areas, they're supposed to be roadless, and we know that, except there is a few roads in some of the roadless areas, but usually they're not used. And if there is, there's a special exception for those, for certain emergency-type operations and that. To go back to the question from the other good senator's issue with whether or not the county commissioners would be able to do this, apparently this... by writing this law, because according to what the judge, let me read what the judge said, the federal judge, who happens to just be here from Cheyenne. He said that he ruled that because the Wyoming road statutes did not allow for the creation of Wyoming roads unless in strict compliance with Wyoming Statute 241101 little a, regardless of whether the road was located on public or private lands, RS-2477, so we're going right to RS-2477, which means public land roads, would not force the federal government to recognize county roads across federal public lands. And it very well may be this, though. But then again, they may go back and let us do that. But we, first of all, before we could even go to court to even prove that, we got to have a statute on the books that the judge has can look at, and that's what we're really trying to do here, I believe.
Additional questions on House Bill 125?
Jim, I've listened to that explanation, and I've still – so suppose then what you're saying is there are two aspects of this. One is if you do create a county road, that means the county's got to go out and start maintaining it. And so the way I read this is that, so I've got a piece of land. I went out and bought it. There's a road. I've got some BLM property, a lease, and there's a two-track running across it. And sometime before 1976, a neighbor who's now dead 25 years, he used that road a couple times to go through my BLM property. And so now, then he stopped using it for 20 years and because he's got other access. New owners come in, they split up the ranch, and they say, well, simply because there was a private access to an ag operation, that's now sufficient to make it a public road?
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to answer one of the comments that if it's a public road, the county has to go out and maintain it, that's just not true. You don't have to, if you're a county, you don't have to maintain a public road. You still have the right to bring that onto your road system if you choose to do that. There's a lot of roads out there, like particularly up in my country, that are designated on section lines because that's the way they laid it all out. Now with a particular situation of terrain, hills, whatever it might be, you can't follow that section line, so the road will be built and maintained in a different location, and after a certain period of time, by prescription, that's where that road is. But there's nothing that says that the county has to maintain a public road.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, and we want to be a little bit careful what we do here, and I agree. The county establishes lots of roads that they don't maintain. However, that doesn't mean the public doesn't use them. And particularly in my part of the state where we get really mixed ownership between state and sometimes sections of state ground, sometimes 40s of BLM all the way up to large chunks of BLM. And if you really read what this says, and I happen to have the Oregon Trail going through my place, I suppose it now qualifies as a county road. But you're opening a door that I'm not sure you want opened. As soon as it, with actions like this, whether there's a road there or not, people start going there. And it'd be a shame, but I use the Oregon Trail only half in jest. If you drive over it, you can see it now and all those things. It's fine. But if you take a bunch of people with four-wheel drives driving over that, you would ruin that site. This opens up a box that really doesn't need to be opened. If the public needs a road, there's a proper way to do it without trying to kind of come in and just sort of lay it out there. If there's a need, and up in Powder River Basin, we've seen the need for many, many roads, and we put them in place. And we've done it right. We've done it straightforward. They're working, and the county maintains some, and the county chooses not to maintain some. And then quite often, other entities maintain them because it makes sense. But this is not the way to establish a road. It truly isn't. There's no consideration on what you want to get done, the need for it, those kind of things. That all flies out the window when you go this route to establish a county road.
Senator Cooper?
In order to try to keep up with some of the questions, Mr. Chairman, as far as going across public lands, I don't believe this bill even affects that because, first of all, the road would have had to, for the county commissioners declared a public road, it would have had to been used for 10 years across somebody's private land, and they would have had to maintain it in order to take adverse possession of the road to begin with. That's the way the rules are written. That's the way they are in the statutes today. Had dealings with many of those. So that will take care of that. As far as a previous question on or comment on somebody having a homestead out there and building, this says you have to have a home out there and you have to be using this road for a number of years before 1976 or by 1976 or in those areas there. You have to have a house out there on that homestead, or you have to have an ag operation out there of some sort that you've been using for years. And this all goes to the RS-2477 rules, which they have. The RS-2477 have the rules that require certain things to be done before you can just declare it a road anyway. So there's a lot of things that go on here before you can just say, hey, the county commissioner, we're going to make this a county road. Any of you who have been commissioners in here know that just doesn't happen, and there's a number of things. And I've been involved in several of them as a commissioner trying to declare public roads for the county, and I can guarantee you most of them didn't happen.
Senator Meyer?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it just sounds like we're trying to get access to your property, or your operation. This doesn't seem like we're opening up that big of a box. I know my neighbors from time to time have gotten into some defugalies or whatever, and they needed to get access across somebody's land so they could get to another piece of ground. And there's a process that you can do it on a private matter. And it's not so much a public road, but it's more of an access road. But I don't envision these roads having a lot of high traffic and a lot of high volume. I think you're only volume is going to be there is what's at the end of it. So, you know, I think we're seeing things that go bump in the night that maybe aren't there. But, I think everybody deserves access to their private property. If you get by a piece of property and it's landlocked, whether you're there before 75 or there before 95, I think you still deserve access.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, speaking on and for the bill, it does seem to me this is limited. This is limited to the federal lands. And I think it's important because we're having a circumstance where the federal government is increasingly trying to lock its lands up and deny people access. And anything we can do to slow that process down and preserve some of the access that our constituents have is, I think, very important. Let's not lose sight of what's really going on here. This doesn't affect the private lands. This is just the federal lands. And it's a practical step we can take to combat the effort to lock the federal lands up.
Senator Nicholas?
Mr. Chairman, I guess as we're moving through this, if you have private land that is landlocked and your only access is through federal land, there's a federal statute, the acronym is ANICLA, I think it's the Alaska National Land Act. I forget the interim acronym, but that act says if you end up having a piece of property here and your only access is through federal lands, the people managing the federal lands are required by law to give you a private access. You do it by a permit. So there is a provision protecting private access. I'm not aware of what the significance of the 1976 is, and perhaps there was a change in federal law that said that made a distinction that as long as I've been practicing, I think that if you want to establish a public road across public lands, you have to go out and go through a permit process, and the county goes through that process. But fundamentally, without even getting to those issues as to what the law change was, those things, let's look what the purpose of Wyoming statute was. Look at lines 4 and 5 on page 2, the original language, that this is a process to establish and record as necessary, which are important for public use, so to permanent roads, and to cause such roads to be recorded. Now what's happening is the proponents of the bill are proposing to say that except for roads that are located on public lands, which provide private residents or private agricultural operations, shall be highways. So we've taken a public use statute which creates a highway and a public use, and now saying if you have a private road on it, that is now a highway public use. Fundamentally, they're two different things. And you can't establish, I submit to you, a public road by just going out and saying it's the old deal where the neighbor comes to you and says, I can't get access through your property, so I'm going to go to the county commissioners and declare a county road through your property for one person. That's not a public use.
Senator Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, maybe I didn't quite understand what the good senator from Albany County was saying, but I don't see anything in this amendment that says anything about a private road. It says except roads located on federal public lands prior to October 1976, which provide access for a private residence or agricultural operation. I can't see where this could affect, unless I was reading the conversation wrong, where it has anything to do with declaring roads across private land.
Anybody else want to go down this road? All those in favor of Senator Von Flatern's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 125, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
No.
House Bill 125 is passed Committee of the Whole. Okay. No. Next bill for our consideration is House Bill 114.
House Bill number 114, sponsored by the Education Committee, Community Colleges Amendments and Act Relating to Community Colleges. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Coe, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Flatern, Senator Coe, Chairman. It was re-referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriation. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Nicholas, Peterson, Townsend, No, Senator Meyer, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
Heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, moving the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do-pass recommendation on House Bill 114. There is a standing committee amendment. Ask that it be read in at this time.
I do with it? House Bill 114, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to endorse copy, page 2, line 12.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Move the Standing Committee Amendment, and we'll deal with that, Mr. Chairman, after we've gone through the bill. That'll be carried by Senator Massey at the time. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll go ahead and kick off the discussion on House Bill 114, Community College Amendments. And for the benefit of some of the newer members, I'll tell you where this bill came from. It came about from last year's 2008 Wyoming Session Laws, Chapter 48, Section 327. Section 327 created a Community College Planning Task Force to consist of the following, and it was the Chairman of Senate Education, Chairman of House Education, plus two other members from each body, 9 members appointed by the governor, 2 representatives of the Community College Commission, 1 member representing Department of Workforce Services, 1 member representing the Wyoming Travel, Recreation, and Tourism Industry, 1 representing Wyoming Oil and Gas, 1 representing Wyoming Mining Industry, 1 representative of the small business community, 1 representative from Wyoming healthcare industry, and 1 representative of the public. Section 327 charged the task force and said that the task force shall review and evaluate the existing community college system and in conjunction with the state Wallace College system, develop a strategic plan. The task force will conduct a statewide study on the current capacity level of the college system based upon established student population projections and projected state academic and workforce needs. And the task force will create a system which evaluates and prioritizes community college capital construction. The task force will identify options for funding, allocate programming to meet the needs of students in the most cost-effective manner, address the needs of industry, particularly as it pertains to a trained and skilled workforce, will restructure the governance of the community college system, will explore a statewide community college system in respect to governance, revenue generation, and representation on the commission, and create a seamless educational system between K-12 to post-secondary education. It goes on to say that the task force may retain consultants as necessary, which we'll talk about. And it said the task force shall report its findings and recommendations to the Joint Appropriations Interim Committee and the Joint Education Interim Committee by November 1st of 2008. Sections repealed March 31st, 2010. That's Section 327 that created the task force. We also passed last year House Bill 17, College Commission Duties. 2 quick bullet points on that. It requires the commission to develop a statewide biennial community college strategic plan for the delivery of educational programs in the state, which is to serve as a basis for an annual report to the governor and the legislature. It goes on where House Bill 17 directs the commission to review existing certificate and degree programs and to terminate state funding for those programs which have consistently low enrollment. And now, Mr. Chairman, we met at length in the interim. We started in May with a 2-day meeting. We had 2-day meetings in May, June, July, August, September, and October, and a 1-day meeting in November and December. We met a lot. What you see in House Bill 114, I think, does about 2 or 3 really important things. One of the directives was to define the state interests. What are the state's interests in the community college system for the $217 million, or roughly thereabouts, that we spend? It also defines the local interests. There is a local interest involved here. We have 7 distinct community colleges representing 7 distinct areas of the state. I think that what this bill does is integrate the interests of the state with the local efforts so that we create one distinct college that does both of those entities. In summary of House Bill 114, it's a continuation of the statewide community college system strategic plan effort. It strengthens the authority significantly of the Wyoming Community College Commission to review and approve education programs, has the ability to terminate state funds for programs inconsistent with the plan, has the ability to redirect delivery of programs to accomplish statewide interests. It has a separation of the biennial budget development process. It talks about establishing a baseline amount upon which to base the biennial budget request, subject to adjustment for enrollment, subject to the effects of inflation, and subject to the addition of new programs or expansion. It has a continuation of the funding allocation model for commission distribution of legislative appropriations. That's a key to the bill. Establishment of the community college capital construction process. This is a brand new process. College building needs are prioritized. There is an attachment to state interest defined by the strategic plan. The strategic plan drives all of those through a prioritization process. It has a linkage directly, as you'll hear when we go through the three different sections, to the legislatively approved construction appropriations. You'll find that we define the CAPCON side as we explain the CAPCON side to the Department of Administration and Information. Based on the fact that as we had this discussion in the interim, we talked about creating our own entity. We'll, through the Community College Commission, we'll go out and do all this stuff and, you know, redefine what's going on here. We chose to use the system that's already in place through the Department of Administration and Information that is headed up the director, I think it's Senator Cathcart or former Senator Cathcart. I probably shouldn't allude to his name, but that's who's in charge of it. With that, Mr. Chairman, I think we'll go ahead and get right into the bill. And with that, the first nine pages will be explained by Senator Massey, who will deal with the CAPCON side.
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Starting on page 2 in subsection A is a nice summary of the next 8 pages they're going to follow. It summarizes the process that the task force is recommending with defining the capital construction and the major maintenance needs of the colleges and also establishing a procedure for them to convert that information and priorities into budget requests to the legislature. And as I go through here, I'll mention a couple of the elements of the amendments. Most of the amendment that you see in front of you, the Standing Committee Amendment number 1, is mostly cleanup of wording throughout the bill. But there's a couple of content or rather meaningful amendments in places. And the first one is on page 2, line 12. And plugging that into lines 11 and 12 on page 2, essentially, subsection A says this. As part of its administrative functions, the Community College Commission shall identify community college building needs, develop a prioritized list of what those capital construction needs are among the 7 colleges, and then forward recommendations for funding of that prioritized list to the State Building Commission through ANI. And the through an ANI part will be, you'll see later on in the ensuing pages here. So that's how the capital construction process works in this bill. The Community College Commission's going to be working with the community colleges and identifying what those building needs are. They will then develop a prioritized list, and then based upon that list of priorities, make decisions on what they're going to recommend to ANI and eventually to the State Building Commission on what's the building or what the construction list will look like and how much funding it will take to do the construction. The second part of it is major maintenance, and that starts on line 15 of page 2. The major maintenance request will come directly to the legislature. Capital construction will go through ANI and State Building Commission and then eventually through our budgeting process. Major maintenance will come directly to the legislature, and that will be based upon, among other things, a formula that's provided by ANI. So that's the process that's summarized in subsection A. The ensuing 8 pages put some details to that process. In order to carry out these 2 duties, the commission will establish a building database, and they're going to be working with the colleges in developing long-range plans for capital construction and major maintenance needs, as well as working with the colleges in conducting assessments of the building conditions. And that's the language on page 3 and 4 that's in the bill. Jumping down to the bottom of page 4, is the requirement to the State Building Commission that it begin to set up a priority list of capital construction needs. So they're going to develop this database. They're going to work with the colleges on identifying what the capital construction needs are. They're going to gather all this information, and then they're going to start to prioritize it. And the priority will be very specific to the next fiscal year, which will start shaping their budget request to ANI and eventually to the State Building Commission. But also, that prioritized list will go out to 4 years, four additional years. So essentially be a five-year prioritized list with the top year being the projects that they're going to be recommending through the process in the next year. The prioritization will also be based, as noted in the top of page 5, on the statewide capacity for education programs. So this is where the capital construction and major maintenance ties in to the strategic plan. The strategic plan is going to identify what the state's interests are in specific educational programs. And then based upon that, we'll help them determine exactly what the state's interests are going to be in the square footage and the building needs out at the community colleges. And there will also be basing this prioritized list upon Too Little I, page 5, on an analysis of student enrollment changes into the future. So they're going to take an idea of what kind of community college enrollment and how that's going to change in the coming years and how that will then interpret into building needs. Down on the bottom of page 5, the commission can modify this priority list based upon new information that comes to them. Okay, so it's not set in stone. Over on page 6, they will provide this data and the information and the priority projects that they come up with to ANI, including the square footage that's needed to deliver the educational programs identified in the strategic plan. They will send the prioritized list over to ANI by November 15th of every year, and ANI will do a level 2 study before sending recommendations for funding requests over to the State Building Commission. And the SBC then will review what ANI sends to them. And just like all the other buildings, or most of the other buildings that we take on in state government, they'll make recommendations, and then those recommendations will be forwarded to the legislature through our budgeting process. And that's essentially explained, Mr. Chairman, on pages 6 and 7. Now, with regard to major maintenance, dropping to the bottom of page 7, the commission shall also provide copies of the needs assessment and these construction priorities, and then jumping over the top of page 8, as well as the major maintenance square footage and the major maintenance needs calculated by the formula from ANI directly to the members of the legislature by December 1st of each year. The legislature will appropriate the major maintenance money back to the commission, and then the commission is authorized through statute to distribute those to the colleges, again, based upon the formula that comes from ANI. In J, the commission will also distribute state funds for building commission, for building construction back to the colleges. The payments by the commission shall be contingent upon the receipt of any local district funding. So part of this process in determining the building needs, the capital construction needs, as well as the major maintenance needs, will be a calculation of what the colleges must contribute as well. And as you see with an amendment on line 14, I believe it is, on page 8, yes, the Education Committee inserted some clarification there, indicating when that local district funding money needs to be committed before the state money for capital construction is released to the colleges. The rest of the language on pages 8 and 9 give authority to ANI to approve the phases of the construction that the community colleges will then go through. So ANI will have general oversight of the construction for community colleges. Mr. Chairman, that explains the process for capital construction, as well as for major maintenance. I now yield to Senator DeCaria to carry the bill on for the next few pages.
Just for a second, I think we overlooked one of the standing committee amendments on page 9, line 8, where we delete building and facility and insert maintenance. And I think, if I'm right, we did overlook that part of the Standing Committee Amendment. Now, with that, Mr. Chairman, I would defer to the second phase.
Senator Nicholas?
This is a question. I'd like to get a better understanding of what the committee's process was, how this works. So if I would contrast it, for example, to the old certificate of need process for hospitals, except you've got a statewide hospital system. Well, okay. The notion of certificate of need is you go out and do your need, and you got a need for 500 beds. Whoever builds the 500 beds gets the 500 beds, and nobody else gets them. If there's 400 beds out there, and then you can go out and build 100 beds. So in this process, you do your statewide system, your needs, and your capacity assessment. And so suppose you happen to be a college up in the northeast corner with some local resources. So how does this work? I mean, if you want to build a brand new building to house the college for welding, per se, and do you then go and say what the capacity is? Now, I'm going to pay for the building myself, so I'm prepared to go to the legislature and pay entirely. And do I have to wait till the building gets up on the needs assessment to do it, or do I go and say, notwithstanding that you prioritized all this need capacity, we would like to have a building, we'd like to have it paid for? And so, I mean, I understand the notion of, okay, you bring all these requests, priorities, you go to the legislature and you say, we need $100 million for capital construction to do these top ones. So that's the request for $100 million. Northeast College comes in down and says, well, that's all great and fine, but we think there's a capacity and a need for a college of XYZ, and we're going to pay for it. What happens?
Senator Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You can never predict what happens in the legislature, but this is the process and how it's set up. It's all driven by the strategic plan. So the strategic plan will identify, working with the colleges, what the educational programs are that's in the state's interest. And then that drives the capital construction and the major maintenance needs. And so if using the example of a welding class up in the northeast part of the state, if that's fairly high on the priority list and they need a building for it, then that's going to show up fairly quickly on the priority list that the commission sends to A&I in order to start working on. And then in that process, the commission will determine what's the state share and what's the local college's share in putting that building together. Now, I think with your example, if it's lower down on the list, then it doesn't matter really what the funding capacity of that local college is. Even if that local college can just simply say, we'll fund the whole thing, just give us approval for bonds, they could come to the legislature anytime they want to and make that request individually. But as far as going through this process, it'll be determined by that strategic plan, and then that building need will be judged against the other building needs in the state. And if the other building needs are attached to priorities that are higher than that welding class, then those building needs are going to show up before this one. So keep in mind, the priority lists go out for 5 years. And so the colleges, if they have a true building needs that's attached to a program, to an educational program that the Community College Commission has identified through its strategic plan as having a state interest in, more than likely it's going to get scheduled somewhere along those 5 years. Now, it may not be of immediate need, and the class that they're hoping to host in that building may not be at the top of the educational program priority list. So it may not be in the first year, but they're going to know where they're going to be sitting, and probably somewhere in that 1 to 5 years that they're going to be slowly cycling through. So, to sum it up, capital construction needs are based upon the educational programs and the state's interest in those educational programs identified in the strategic plan. And then, based upon the educational programs, the commission is going to be working with each of the colleges to say, okay, what are your capital facility needs and major maintenance needs in order to deliver these programs that the state has indicated are priority needs? So that's how the state's interests are developed through the process.
Senator Bebout, I believe you were the first one up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. And you said, as I understand it, that if, in fact, the district had the money and they wanted to do it, they can come here and do it anyway, just build whatever they want because they've got the money. How does that fit into the major maintenance? How does the major maintenance component of it as far as calculating it? Second question is, on page 8, if you really look at lines 10 through about 15 or 20, it seems to me that the way this is set up is a community college district that has more access to money, although they may not want to pay all of it, would be able to enhance their priorities because they have more money to be able to build the projects. And so then there's those poorer districts, maybe like in the eastern, southeastern part of the state, maybe in the north central part of the state, may not have the money to do it, or in the central part of the state where others might. So I think that might skew the prioritization you give for construction projects. Then the last thing on page 6 where you talk about you're going to have a strategic plan to, that's going to tell you how to deliver the program, and based on what that said, you're going to calculate the square footage necessary to do that, and that sounds to me like you're going to try to find some consultants, they're going to come up with their plans, and we're going to have to hire a bunch of people to interpret their plans, then go to the colleges to interpret our interpretation, then come to here so we can understand what they all said. And I'm trying to figure out what that means.
Senator Goh.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on what the Chairman of Appropriations, just a little bit more to add what the good tall Senator from Laramie said. You take prioritized projects, requests, based on the strategic plan. As a good senator from Laramie said, that's forwarded to the General Services Division, Department of A&I, for project study and review under Wyoming Statute 951088(i). Then following review and in consultation with the commission, the reviewed prioritized project is recommended to the State Building Commission for inclusion at that point in budget legislation assembled pursuant to 951088(i)(j) for legislative approval and authorization. Now, that's to answer the Chairman of Appropriations' question just a little bit further. With that, does somebody else want to take a shot at the good senator from Fremont County's question?
Senator Von Vladeren.
And I believe the question was on line or page 8 in the center there, where it says schedule payments by the commission shall be contingent upon receipt of local district funds. That is if there are any. It has nothing to do with the prioritization aspect or whether or how this is going to be funded, but if the college itself says we do have some funds, we need this much, you know, $3 million, and we have $1 million in donations or a benefactor that's going to give it to us, then that's fine. That'll be written in that, you know, how it'll be paid. It doesn't say that any of these projects will require local funds or local resources, but I'm sure that if you have X amount of dollars to start, prioritization might be a little better. But I would only say that because, once again, we're doing state needs. So if you want to build it yourself, you want to do the major maintenance yourself, and it doesn't quite fit within the strategic plan or it doesn't fit high enough to shoot you to the top, I'm sure that you pretty well can take care of it yourself with approval of square footage. This, and we're a bit nearsighted in this, and I will agree with the senator from Laramie, we probably didn't address 100% everything by local resources as well as we could have, because everything was based on trying to identify state needs and a process to handle state needs. So nothing in here says that local resources will be required for any project. It doesn't say that your priority will be higher because you have some more local resources than others. It's just saying that if you are coming with that package, that the local match, if there is such, because you've said there is, will be written out, stated, and this language was to say that the state funds will be doled out accordingly.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr.
Chairman, I know a lot of work went into this process, but I'm trying to evaluate as we go through this is whether we have created a better system, a statewide system, to go out and determine what our needs capacity are and do an orderly construction and determination of what we're going to pay for and how do we limit the construction because we're called on as a state to pay a large portion of the major maintenance, the student cost. It's our expense. And I wonder when as I'm going through this bill, whether or not all we've done is created and equipped a better advocacy group to come and insist and demand on more money with an outlet over here that we can build all we want, construct all we want, and of course when we construct and build, we compete with each other. We don't solve the problem, the internal problem where one college grows at the expense of the other college. And so if you're saying all capital construction has to come in private, it doesn't make a difference whether it's private dollars, your dollars, we're going to prioritize on a system-wide needs. That's a system of higher education and say, well, we only need this much capacity in the state to satisfy it. Frankly, even though you want this program, this building over here down in the other part of the state already has capacity. Let's go ahead and use that building to do it. The students should go down here to get that one. We're going to work with a finite amount of assets. If the notion is the Community College Commission, which are essentially an advocates for the college, say, okay, let's get together and create a list. We know the list's going to be big. And then we're going to send it to A&I, which is an agency that we fund, and going to do all these level one studies. Well, level one study, as I understand it and as I've seen, is it really a statement of what's the need, what's the capacity, what's it going to look like, all that stuff. It's almost it's a significant document. So if we're going to have A&I have to respond, we're going to pay now the cost to do all these level ones for the colleges at the insistence of the Community College Commission, not the director of A&I saying, here's what you get to do, or the governors. We now have community colleges bringing in work to A&I and say, well, we want you to do 35 level ones this year, or 10 level ones, or one level one on these facilities. And then you create a needs list. What I'm seeing is a lot of thinking and a lot of collective, developed thought that we've generated over the years in funding K-12 permeating into this bill. So the notion is we have an obligation to fund. Let's go out and find out what the capacity is. Let's put the budget together, and we have some obligation to fund it. Except that with the K-12, we're limited. It's that we're going to decide everything. Here we're saying, except that if you've got your own resources, as long as you can go to the commission and say it's an important thing and they put it on the list, you can pay for it yourself or go to the legislature. That's my concern. I guess we need to get through that.
Senator Massey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wow. I didn't read that in there anywhere. I mean, there was a lot of ifs to get to that scenario. It's not there. I mean, that wasn't the vision of the task force. It's not written into the statute. I'm not really quite sure how to address that. It's pretty straightforward what the process is here. There is no authorization anywhere in statute, including right here, that would allow a college to go out on its own without legislative authority and approval and conduct a major and build a major building and then ask the state to fund a major maintenance. It's not going to happen. The only way that will happen is if they come to us and we approve it. So that's still there. I mean, but I don't know if we need something in here to protect ourselves from ourselves. The only way that's going to happen is if we authorize the bonding. Otherwise, they have to go through this process. The process is intentionally trying to get rid of the present problem that we have of me next, and that is every college going to the commission now and saying, last year these four colleges were funded for capital construction, now it's my turn, without any kind of consideration of what the priorities are for the state, let alone what the state share should be in that. So that eliminates that altogether. The whole purpose of this is for, and we haven't gotten to it yet, it's over on page 10, and Senator DiCaria will explain that, but The Community College Commission, in conjunction with the colleges, will develop a strategic plan that's going to drive this entire process. And it's going to be based upon the state's interest in college education. And what is it that's in the state's interest? Now, there could still be a local interest, and that's fine. And if those colleges want to build something on their dime to fulfill a local interest, they still have to go through the process and still have to come down here to get it approved by the legislature to do that. But the way the process is set up now is based upon those educational programs. And there will be that discussion of saying, gee, do we need a welding or do we need an auto shop class at all seven of the colleges? That'll be a discussion. The answer is going to be no. This is where they're going to be at. And this is what's going to be in the state's interest, and that's what the state's going to pay. So you go to those two colleges, and they say, this is where we're going to have the auto classes, and this is where we're going to have our instruction in career and technical education on autos. And then they're going to work with the college. The commission will work with the community colleges and say, what are your building needs? They may not have any at all, but they may have the building needs, and they're going to work with the community colleges to identify what those are. And they're going to come up with this database, which is on page 3, of all the different data all the different capital construction needs around the state of Wyoming. They will come up with a building database as noted on lines 11 and 12 of page 3. Then based upon all that data that they've gathered from all the community colleges and based upon the strategic plan, the Community Colleges Commission will then develop a priority list of capital construction needs. They will then take those capital construction needs, which will be identified with square footage and cost in order to do it, what the state share is going to be and what the local share will be, and they will forward the top of that priority list to A&I and to their capital construction division there, the same one that works on all of the process for developing capital construction projects for the state of Wyoming. They will then integrate that priority list into their existing work. They're going to be working with the college and the Community College Commission on coming up with the details, doing the various design work, which I think is located, here somewhere in which they're authorized to begin doing project review, and value engineering and the other work with the various community colleges. Now, there's no time frame for that. It doesn't say they're going to have to do this in a month or 2 months or even that particular year. They're going to integrate it in with their existing workload, and when they have those projects ready to go, when they've done the level two, they will then forward those over to the State Building Commission. The State Building Commission will look at those projects just like they do all the other state projects, and they'll make recommendations on it. Fund or do not fund, and then those recommendations are forwarded to the governor. The governor will say yes or no in his budget message to the Joint Appropriations Committee and the legislature, and then that's the process that we'll fund. And then whatever it is we fund, that's taken off the list, and the Community College Commission will then go to the next buildings on the list. And then based upon changes in student enrollment and based upon changes in the educational programs identified by priority in the strategic plan, those building needs may get shuffled, but they're going to be strictly driven by the educational needs, not upon the whims of the colleges. I think it's a pretty straightforward process. There will be some consultants involved, but this is going to be run through the commission in working very closely with A&I in developing these capital construction plans. And what we're going to see here in the legislature is going to be very similar to the level of information that we get on all the other state buildings that the state has.
Senator DeCaria? I'm sorry, Senator DeCaria, you got overridden. Mr. Majority Floor Leader?
Mr. Chairman, I think this would be an appropriate time to allow staff to have a break. So if Senator DeCaria will excuse me, I will move that the committee of the whole beg leave to rise and set again in about 10 minutes.
All those in favor of the Majority Floor Leader's motion, say aye.
Aye.
We're about 10 minutes to come back. Committee of the order, Committee of the Whole, come back to order. Charlie's not here. We could. Who? We need about two or three more guys on the floor, please. You ready? We need to. All right, here we go. We're going to pick back up and have something from Senator Conan. Between these next sections, can we write our questions down and then pick them up at the end? Because some of the questions that were being asked were going into the next sections. Senator Coe?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we were on the capital construction side, and I believe that Senator DeCaria had a question or a comment before we move on to the governance side.
Senator DeCaria.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to make the point that you just talked about, that if we can get through the bill and explain it, some of these questions will start to answer some of the questions, and then we can answer the other ones that come up from that, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, 2118-202 deals with the governance of the Community College Commission. Mr. Chairman, on page 10, there are several parts. The first part, Section A, deals with the functions of the community college. They'll have following general functions. And as you see, and a lot of this, as has been referred to a couple of times, is really driven by the strategic plan. And so one of the functions is to develop that plan, the statewide community college system strategic plan, and that would be the function. Mr. Chairman, I will talk about that more when we get to it. It's on page 12, and we can go into that plan in a little more detail. Section C there talks about administrative functions, and those functions, Mr. Chairman, is to prepare budget requests for the operation and support of the community colleges and the commission. Mr. Chairman, this is also where an amendment comes in, and the amendment is down on line 15, and it will change the wording at the end of that in line 15 and 16. After the comma, it will read, prepare budget requests for capital construction and major maintenance, and that will be the end of the sentence. We just, the committee thought that clarified what we were talking about and tells what is actually in that function. In Section D, Mr. Chairman, the approval functions, so they will approve all the new programs that are qualifying for funding under the new strategic plan. And on page 11, in Romanet 2, they're also going to review existing programs to try to figure out the most effective and efficient delivery of those programs, and also to suggest terminating programs that are inconsistent with the community college system strategic plan. Section E, Mr. Chairman, was on the review and reporting functions. So the commission shall provide annual reports to the legislature and the governor on the performance of individual community colleges. And, Mr. Chairman, really in this section, it just took out defined by the legislature and as, because it's going to be driven now by the strategic plan that's going to come into play, Mr. Chairman. On page 12, subsection B, okay, this is the management and information system, and it's going to take out a section in that paragraph. The core measurements defined by the American Association of Community Colleges shall be used. Takes out that wording because, Mr. Chairman, it's going to follow more along the strategic plan that is going to be put into place. So the subparagraph there, C, okay, the reports provided by the commission, the legislature, and governor shall be, okay, and this is the part of this, is they're going to be attached and aligned to the community college system performance benchmarks, outcome measures, and other performance indicators specified in and defined by the strategic plan. Mr. Chairman, and here we are to the strategic plan. That's in subparagraph H. Okay, and the commission shall, prior to the beginning of each biennial budget period, review, update, and modify the statewide college system strategic plan. Okay, and that plan shall clearly prescribe the components of the educational programs and attach program components to statewide system priorities. And so the priorities in the community college system will be the driver for the strategic plan, looking at the statewide interests and what educational programs fit those interests. Romanet I under that, they're going to consult with, and this, Mr. Chairman, just backing up again, in developing and reviewing and updating this plan, the Community College Commission shall, because I think this is going to answer a lot of questions, in Romanet I, they're going to consult with the seven community colleges. All right, so they're going to have input into that, and that includes not the community colleges, but also state and local government agencies and other agencies and organizations representing state economic and industry sectors. So those people are all going to be part of putting the strategic plan together. In Romanet 2, you're going to include the mechanisms within that planning process which adhere to the state's interest in establishing statewide college system identified as assuring statewide access to academic programs, and you see the list of the criteria there. Mr. Chairman, this is also another part where an amendment comes in, and on line 15, it's just going to change adheres to adhere, so, you know, just so that I don't overlook that. But down below, you can see that the statewide plan is going to include lots of things, you know, concurrent enrollment programs, remedial and continuing education programs, employers and state workforce. All of those different components are going to be included in the state's strategic plan as put forward. Mr. Chairman, on page 14, Romanet 3, then they're going to develop the performance benchmarks in this section and the outcome measures that they're going to be judged on for their annual report. And these performance benchmarks will include, but not be limited to, and you'll see a list here of what's going to be there, like A, student goal attainment, retention, B, persistence. Mr. Chairman, this is also another part of the Standing Committee Amendment on line 9. It just said persistence, you know, and we were trying to figure out, well, whose persistence are we talking about? And so in this case, we are going to add the word student persistence so we know that we're talking about keeping students in school, you know, and continuing through the process. And then you can see the list of the other measures that will be included in there. Mr. Chairman, if you go over onto page 15 under Romanet 4, and then they're going to attach those performance indicators to funding. And, Mr. Chairman, this is also another where another amendment comes in. On line 5 there, it removes the word incentives. And so it would just read, attach performance indicators to funding to achieve established results. And so it's clear that what we want to do is we want the dollars to follow the function. And that's what we're talking about in the strategic plan. Mr. Chairman, then in 2118-203, the budget procedure here, okay, and in collaboration with boards of community colleges, the commission is going to look at the compliance with the statewide community college system strategic plan, and their budget will be driven by what's in that plan. Also, Mr. Chairman, to make it clear, is that exception budget requests can be made in a biennium, but those budget requests will not be rolled into the next standard budget by the community colleges. So there can be funding needs that might pop up that might have to be addressed, and they can have that process, but none of those needs will be rolled into that. And Mr. Chairman, that brings up another amendment, which would be on line 22, which should not be included in the standard budget or any subsequent biennial budget request. So it just makes it clear that when they have additional needs that may be brought forward, those funding requests do not get rolled into the standard budget moving forward. That budget is part of the budget that would be developed by the community college. Mr. Chairman, on page 16, 2118-205, the appropriations, the distribution of state funds, Mr. Chairman, the main change here is that the funding allocation model components, okay, by the rule of the commission for fixed variable costs, shall be defined by and computed in accordance with guidelines and procedures prescribed by the rule and regulation of the commission, applied to the distribution of state appropriations for each biennial budget period, and recalibrated at a schedule specified by rule and regulation of the commission, but in no event less than once every 4 years. So that they'll have to go back and look at this plan and the budget process, you know, on a regular basis. Mr. Chairman, on line 17, subsection E, okay, and then it just talks about the commission by exception budget. You know, they can request special purpose funding, but it is clear in this one, the special purpose funding under this subsection shall be limited to amounts for the period of time specified by the legislature and shall not be included in any subsequent biennial budget unless specifically requested by the commission and approved by the legislature. Mr. Chairman, down on Romanet I, this deals with enrollment growth, and if that comes up and that special purpose funding is allocated because of enrollment growth, that additional appropriation has to be used for enrollment growth and cannot be diverted for other functions. It deals with the need that the money is given out for. Mr. Chairman, that brings us over to page 18, Romanet 2, that the special purpose funding requested under the subsection in funding new programs addressing unanticipated and emerging statewide needs during the biennial budget period, which are consistent with the statewide community college system strategic plan, funds that are appropriated here shall be accounted for separately and shall not be transferred or expended for any other purpose or as part of the state assistance under subsection C. So again, these special purpose funds, you know, are used and accounted for separately. Mr. Chairman, almost to the end here of my section on 2118-304, this just talks about the community college district boards, okay, and that they are the ones that are going to be charged with developing and maintaining the comprehensive plan of district buildings, looking at the long-term needs, you know, and that will take into with education space needs attached to the statewide college system strategic plan. And those building plans are would be included in that section. Mr. Chairman, and then section 3 are some repealers. Mr. Chairman, 2118-202B, Romanet 7, is the old strategic plan. Since we're putting a new process in for a strategic plan, we can get rid of the old strategic plan that's in statute. And, Mr. Chairman, the other one, E5C1 through 8 and D, is repealed. And those are the old performance benchmarks, Mr. Chairman. And with that, I will pass the torch to my esteemed colleague.
One moment, Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, just for those that are, and believe me, we had a huge discussion and there's a lot of concern. You'll see another amendment coming later in this process about loss of local control as it relates to the seven community colleges. Draw your attention to the section, the last section just covered, 2118-304. And I want to tell you what our intent was, and I think it does that. The additional component to the funding process, both in terms of operational and facility funding, in this section is the granting of necessary authority to the commission for the recognition of individual community college characteristics and unique assets, linking this recognition to the allocation of state resources. I think it's very important this section does that. And with that, we'll move on to the last section, initial strategic plan development. If there's no questions, then defer to Senator Von Flader.
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4, initial strategic plan development, starts on page 19. This is where they actually develop how they're going to develop their plan. As it says on line 20, and prior to development of the 2011-2012 biennial budget, that they need to have this plan in place and use it to develop that budget. And, of course, is amended by Section 2 of this Act. If you go on to the next page, it talks about following discussions with and consideration of contributions by the 7 community colleges, state local government agencies, other agencies and organizations representing state economic and industry sectors. So all these groups will get together to write the strategic plan. If you go to line 14, they will schedule and conduct a joint meeting of the commission, representatives of the governor, the legislative joint appropriations, joint education, and representatives of the community college planning task force for purposes of joint consideration of the preliminary statewide strategic plan. Line 23, very important, on or before the end of July, July 31st of this year, prepare a draft strategic plan as a result of the joint meeting that was just held. Line 6, line 8, page 21, utilize draft statewide strategic plan forward under this paragraph of this subsection for basis for assembling the 2011 and 12 biennial budget recommendations for operational and facility major maintenance funding. On to section 5. They'll submit the draft statewide strategic plan forward and under paragraph 3 of this subsection to each president of the 7 community colleges. Everybody's involved here when we put the strategic plan together. It is not the college commission working on high or the college commission working with this community college task force that we put together. Everybody's involved here. Then after they have this draft, it goes to the 7 community college. Each president or their designee shall review the draft plan and shall appoint a designee to report back to the commission prior to November 1st of 09. Their final report date is required under the session prior to the timeline of November 1st, 2009. The last sentence on 21, upon approval of a majority of the designees of each of the 7 community college boards of trustees, the commission then shall forward the draft statewide strategic plan. This is upon approval of a majority of your colleges. So once again, everybody's involved, everybody votes on this. Once again, a majority rules. So you go down to page 22, prior to completion of the final statewide strategic plan by November 1st, and following approval of a majority of the district board designees in accordance with the paragraph before, convene an additional joint meeting of the commission, representatives of the governor, legislative joint appropriations, and joint education interim committee, and once again, representatives of the community college planning task force. Everybody gets to see it again. This is our final proposal. So recommendations for the components of the plan to be applied for the 11 and 12 biennium shall be presented at the meeting. You go down to line 20, at the end, it says, based upon discussions resulting from this meeting, a statewide strategic plan reflecting meeting discussions shall be forwarded by the commission to the governor. To the governor, members of the Joint Appropriation, Joint Education, Interim Committees, and members of the Community College Planning Task Force. Not only did everybody go over it again and talk about it, and they finalized the final description, they sent it all back to us. So now we all know what's in there. We've all had say as to what's in there, and we all okay it again. Page 23, they have participants of the joint meeting conducted under that paragraph, this subsection, within 30 days after receipt of a plan forwarded under this paragraph, file an exception to or concern with the forwarded plan. Once again, if this you've worked on it, you've seen it, you added more to it, you've got a final report, you still don't like it, you've got this 30 days to file exceptions and concerns with the plan. And then on starting on line 14 of 23, report the final statewide strategic plan developed under this section to the governor and members of the legislature prior to the commencement date of the 10 budget session of the legislature together. So by next February, once again, we have the final together with any specific recommendations forwarded. So once again, when we come back in February, we will have the final plan and any other forwarded recommendations from the College Commission. If you go to page 24, in computing the distribution of state appropriations in accordance of that Wyoming statute as amended by Section 2 of this Act for the biennium commencing July 1 and ending June 30th, so the next biennium, the Commission shall not consider the balance of any unrestricted operating funds carried forward by any college. So we're starting a baseline budget here. We are allowing them not to, we will not consider the balance of any unrestricted operating funds carried forward by any college from previous biennial budget periods. So their baseline allows them to take their reserves in without counting that separately, but as their base budget. And then there's an amendment on page 24, line 8, after the Wyoming statute 21-18-205F, delete through the word act. So as amended by the section of this act. So that now reads, starting on line 7, from previous biennial budget periods pursuant to Wyoming statute and existing on June 30th, 2010. So any reserves they built up are not counted and is thrown into their base budget. So you get down to B, line 15, as amended by Section 2 of this Act, the Commission shall adjust the total 910 state appropriations to the community college system as approved and adopted by the legislature, combined with the total amount collected from the college 4-mill levy required under Wyoming statute, as considered by the funding allocation model during the same period, by adding to this amount the sum of the reserve fund balance authorized under the following Wyoming statute. So in other words, their reserves are going, by adding this amount to the reserves, their 4 mills collected, the reserves they have, that's their bottom line. The state is going to make up the difference in their request based on the strategic plan and the college's request. Now, Section 6, page 25, hold harmless. This changed. When we were doing this in September, you can imagine that we felt a lot better about how much money the state was going to have. Since things have changed radically, what this section said, we were going to guarantee them that they would have the same money they had in a previous biennium going forth in the next biennium. And we said that's not going to work. No agency is being guaranteed that. In fact, they're all being told to look at cutting 5 to 10%. We said, good luck with your budget. There's an amendment there. If you go to page 25, line 11, after the word shall, you delete the balance of the line and insert. Recommend in its 2011-2012 biennial budget request submitted to the governor an amount not less than the same level of general funds for community colleges that was appropriated by the legislature during the 09-10 biennium. They can request it. We're not telling them they're going to get it. Put it in. We'll see how things go. And then page 25, lines 12 through 24, you just delete the rest of the hold harmless clause. And you go to page 26, and you delete lines 1 and 2. And that talks about how they're going to do the strategic plan. It talks about how they're going to start their baseline funding. And it talks about how we're going to review it. Several of the committees here. If you have concerns, you have 30 days to voice those concerns. The commission will finally put it all together, bring it back to us before we come back here next February, or have it ready for us by the time we come here in February. Plus, they will use that strategic plan to base their next budget. So with that, I will turn it back to the Chairman of Education.
Senator Coe.
Okay, do we have any questions on the governance or the strategic planning section? If not, Senator.
Senator Bebop.
Mr. Chairman, one quick question. When you were talking about the, on page 21, the last line up on approval of a majority of the colleges, did you have any discussion about a supermajority? Because there's four larger colleges and three smaller ones. If you had a supermajority, that would mean five would have to decide instead of four, which might ease a little of the pain for the smaller colleges. I just wonder if you had a discussion in that vein.
Senator Coe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, we did, and this was actually, with the good senator from Fremont County, the last amendment that was added to this bill at our meeting in November, and there was no discussion of that. The intent of the bill, of the amendment, was to treat all seven the same, where a majority of the seven community colleges or their designee got a chance to to vote for the strategic plan or not. So we did not discuss that.
Senator Scott?
Mr. Chairman, if you want to discuss it, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a bad idea. It makes it too hard to get an agreement. I think they'll probably do things largely by consensus. But I think in case there is problems, you need this majority rule in order to get a decision.
Senator Meyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think consensus is the operative word, and you don't get consensus with just a simple majority.
Senator Coe, do you want to pick up the next section?
Mr. Chairman, go into Section 7, Appropriations and Position Authorizations, and draw your attention to a handout I had distributed. Section 7A, the Wyoming Community College Commission has authorized two additional full-time positions to deal with budgeting and allocation of state aid. For that purpose, we propose $200,000 appropriation. Section 7B appropriates $150,000 for management data requirements associated with the administration of the strategic planning responsibilities. Section 7C provides for Level 2 CAPCON to commence efforts to process community college building needs, proposes an appropriation of $250,000. I'm going through these rather quickly because we're going to have a discussion on them. Over on page 28, we do have a standing committee amendment there on page 28, line 6. I got to look at that real quick here. After the word joint, insert appropriations and delete committee, inserting committee. So we bring the joint appropriations committee into the process. That's what that standing committee amendment does. Paragraph 7D, to coordinate with the General Services Division, the Capital Community, the Community College's capital construction process, comes in and authorizes one additional full-time at-will position. Proposes $175,000. Paragraph 7E goes into the needs assessment of the college buildings and needs and proposes an appropriation of $300,000 to maintain the comprehensive assessment of community college buildings and future space requirements. And paragraph 7F, Mr. Chairman, proposes an appropriation of $360,000 for three full-time position or three at-will positions with the General Services Division to conduct planning, develop necessary recommendations for prioritizing on page 30, and to supervise construction. Paragraph 7G proposes an appropriation of $150,000 to develop guidelines and criteria necessary for segregating variable and fixed cost data, as we discussed earlier in the bill. With that, Mr. Chairman, that concludes the bill. I try to answer questions on the appropriation side.
Are there any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1?
Question on the amendment.
All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 on Senate File 114, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Any questions on the bill? Well, I'm just asking her questions on the bill. I know. Would the clerk please read in the bill?
House Bill 114, Standing Committee Amendment Number 2, to engross copy, page 26, line 7.
I'm sorry, Senator Nicholas, but my chairman told me I could not call on you on this bill today. Senator Nicholas.
Well, I move second Standing Committee Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 114. Folks, what we did is, after taking testimony, recommended to you funding of the components of this plan that are ready to go, and remove the funding for the plan that's either not ready for prime time. If you go through the list that was the chairman from Park County just gave to you, going through that, on that first item they requested two positions. One was sort of an expert, and the second was a clerical position. We authorized the clerical position and therefore reduced the funding down to $50,000. This funding is generally for 18 months, and so as you go through here, some of these things we reduced. The second at-will position for the strategic plan, that does need to get funded, so we recommended the full funding for that position, $150,000. For an 18 months of pay.
The next position was the process for the facilities. We don't have the resources to go out to build the facilities right now anyway. That looks to us like that needs further work. We reduced and removed the request for $250,000 in that category. The next item was the at-will position to coordinate CAPCON. Once again, we removed, actually we gave one position there, but reduced the funding to $150,000. So that's the person that's going to be coordinating, going out and starting to develop the school assessment, sort of the MGT coordination function for those that want to translate that to K-12 education. The next item was to develop the comprehensive assessment. That is outside consulting dollars to a firm like the consultants we employed for K-12 to go out and do their facility assessments. That's a contracted amount. It seems to us that that is necessary if you're going to launch this program. So we agree to that amount. The next item was the A&I at-will positions for construction management. Once again, until we get the assessment back and sort of work through this, it's premature, we believe, to hire those positions, so we recommend that we do not create those positions at this time. And then finally, there is the consulting, outside consulting information or cost to build the database for fixed and variable costs, which is the launching pad, if you will, for a new allocation mechanism. That needs to be done in order, once again, to launch this new idea, so we recommended full funding there. The net result is the green bill came in at about $1.5 million, and it came out of the committee number one or two with a recommendation of $800,000 to really pay for the components that need to be started at this time. With that explanation, stand for questions and ask your support.
Senator Coe?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we had a two-hour discussion in committee number two a couple nights ago, and we had a lot of the commission people there. The consensus was that, truthfully, we aren't going to do a lot of this stuff for at least another year and maybe up to 18 months. And so with that short explanation of the amendment, I actually support the amendment and would urge that you adopt it.
Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Nicholas's motion on standing committee amendment number two, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. We're back on the bill. Senator Coe?
With that, Mr. Chairman, try to answer questions or call for the question.
Senator Nicholas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just flipping through my bill here. What I wanted to ask about is a particular word, and once again, we talked a little bit about the facility side of it over at page 50 or 16 of the bill, talking about now on the operating side. And at line 14, you begin to talk about the funding of the allocation model components. Allocation is something that we do all the time, and we drop down to line 18 and 19, and now we bring in a new word, recalibration. It's a word that recalibrated is a word that we're quite familiar with in another context. And I guess I'm interested in some dialogue with respect to why did you select that? Are we really trying to do something where we're going to create a funding model that then is going to get periodically recalibrated? Or are we simply, I don't know that we do that with anything other than K-12. We say kind of this is what we have to work with, and we figure out how much we can afford, and you get it, and you live with it. But if we're back to recalibration, then I guess buckle your seatbelts and let's get ready.
Senator Coe?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to scare anybody with that word recalibration, because that's a lot like when we had the discussion on this. We started out using the word hold harmless in there, and I thought, boy, I don't want to hear that anymore for K-12, so we changed that to max loss. But actually, Mr. Chairman over there of Appropriations, this only relates to, if you go up and start reading in line 14, we're only talking about the two components, fixed cost and variable cost, when we start talking about recalibration. And obviously the fixed costs are determined by costs incurred for physical facilities, related non-variable components, and the variable costs are determined by variable operational costs such as instructional support. I do believe that language is only, as it relates to recalibration, only references fixed costs and variable costs. That was our intent with the language.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, a couple of concerns that some of my trustees had in this bill, and one of them was the every community college has a district now, and their concern was is that during this process that those lines might be redrawn, and I'd like to get a comfort level as to what the discussions were and what the intent is in the strategic plan. What's the underlying current in the strategic plan and how that may or may not affect district lines?
Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, if I understand the question, were you talking about district lines or district boundaries or service areas?
Service areas.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the question had to do with service areas. We had no discussion necessarily about talking about service areas. The only, you know, the one community college up in Casper only serves Natrona County, but we had no real serious discussions about trying to alter the service areas that I'm aware of, and maybe somebody else, maybe the good senator from Gillette recalls, but I don't recall any discussion about that.
Any additional questions on
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Ron Flater.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. It was brought up once in a Ed Committee meeting, but not by the Community College Task Force, so that's the only discussion.
Any more discussion or questions? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when a committee of the whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of House Bill 114, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay.
No.
The House Bill 114 has passed the committee of the whole. If I don't call on you, do we get to do another bill? Senator Majority Floor Leader.
I move that the committee of the whole rise and report.
You heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay.
Reading clerk will read the committee of the whole report.
Mr. President, your committee of the whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to follow up to report as follows. House Bill 262, do pass. House Bill 231, failed to pass committee of the whole and was indefinitely postponed. House Bill 279, do pass. House Bill 125, do pass. And House Bill 114, do pass, amended. Senator Jennings, Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. President, I move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion is adopted. Committee report is adopted. Okay. We have concurrence. Messages from the House.
February the 25th, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 413, Joint Conference Committee Report adopted. Mr. President, Senate File 117, Wyoming Health Insurance Pool Act Eligibility. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee number one report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated, ayes 59, excused 1. Message number 14, Joint Conference Committee Report adopted. Mr. President, Senate Joint Resolution Number 5, Hydraulic Fracturing. The House adopted the Joint Conference Committee Number 1 report on the bill listed above by the vote indicated. Ayes 55, noes 4, excused 1. February the 25th, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 416. Conferees appointed Joint Conference Committee Number 1. Mr. President, the Speaker appointed House conferees to meet with a like committee Number 1 from the Senate on amendments to House Bill 287. The House conferees are Representative Philp, Chairman, Representatives Brown and Pedersen. February the 25th, 2009, from the House of Representatives, message number 415, Committee of the Whole indefinitely postponed. Mr. President, the House adopted the Committee of the Whole report failing the bill listed below by the vote indicated. Senate File 33, Public Easements Abandonment. Ayes 5, noes 55. The bill has been indefinitely postponed. Patricia Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
February the 25th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2 appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 161, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Massey, Meyer, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senator Nicholas. Senator Nicholas, Chairman. February the 25th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 239, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman. February the 25th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 2 appropriations, to whom was referred House Bill 295, engrossed, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Massey, Nicholas, Peterson, and Townsend. No, Senator Meyer. Senator Nicholas, Chairman. House Budget Bill returned from Standing Committee Appropriations Committee. Your committee number 2 appropriations received House Bill 1 pursuant to Joint Rule 14-1E 1 and 2. The following lists are provided. Dispensing with further reading, Senator Nicholas, Chairman.
In accordance with Joint Rule 14-1F1, House Bill 1 is referred directly to third reading. House Bill 1, third reading of the bill.
House Bill Number 1, General, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee, General Government Appropriations, an act relating to supplemental appropriation for the operation of state government, be it enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, are you ready for the explanation?
That's correct.
The Mr.
President, I'm not hearing. He said to go ahead with the explanation. I just didn't hear you. Are you ready for the explanation?
Yes, we're
okay,
ready
thank
for
you.
The explanation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to go through. I noticed the House has sent over a mole, though, and I'm not sure if we ought to be talking about our budget strategy and getting in over here while we've got this House mole. Should we arrest him and just take him off the floor?
He doesn't know what's going on.
Well, I guess that's the answer. No problemo. No risk. No, it's just simply not a threat. Mr. President, the going over the budget, for the new members particularly, you have with you two documents. You've got the House amendments, and then you've got a profile sheet, which we generally call the refer to the as the cheat sheet. And the cheat sheet is the longitudinal 8.5 by 14-inch paper. The way we go through the budget now, it used to be we used to go through some of these line by line, and we would do a roll call on each item, just to get a sense. It would give the committee a sense of where the floor was, but it was also pretty common for every roll call to be 30-1 or 29-1, things like that. So we're going to dispense with the roll call unless, or what we call the votes that we would do. And when you look at the sheet, the first item are the identical amendments. And remember, the identical amendments are mirror amendments that are not available to the conference committee to look at. So the process will be ordinarily that the conference committee will adopt all of the Senate positions or all the House positions. And so the identical amendments in both houses, the first one is the educational finance cleanup already profiled. That was the clarification to ensure that we did not have a double counting for the ECA. There was the amendment on both houses for the Hathaway Scholarship Flow Funding. You recall that is the amendment that we gave financing authority to the treasurers to make sure that there was cash flow going into the Hathaway Scholarship Program. The Casper College Resident Hall, that was private funding for the Resident Hall. That was a mirror amendment on both sides. The Father Factor Program achieved approval in an identical fashion on both sides. The next item is $20,000 for the to take care of this artwork that surrounds us. Once again, joint amendment. The next one is tobacco funds for the increased preventive health budget. It achieved that status. And then finally, we recall that there was a reduction in the wolf management funding. And that was adopted in both houses. So those are the identical amendments. The next amendments are the amendments that are very similar in both houses. And so in that respect, we'll be discussing the margins really between those similar amendments. One of the amendments that actually came on the that was proposed here that failed or that failed here but made it on the other side was the office space for the tribal liaison. You recall that bill that being proposed here failed. The next House third reading amendment is the workforce development funding for the child care providers. As I understand, what the House did is in their first amendment, they added to the business council the $365,000 for those studies for the workforce services, child care providers. That amendment was also it failed here. In that, on the other side, what they did is first give the money to the council and then went back and took the money out of the council. So the amendment's still there, but the and in the end, no new money was added so that the funding would come out of the existing business-ready community dollars, as I understand it. The We have a Senate amendment with respect to the sage-grouse reporting date. There is no mirror amendment, corresponding amendment on the other side. There's a House second reading amendment on the ignition locking program. This amendment failed here. In effect, that they've got a position in there, as I understand it, to fund just in case, or a new position for YDOT in the event that either of those bills pass. Again, that's something that we proposed here that failed. There are near identical amendments with respect to the Medicaid dollars. You recall that we provided that if the in the event that we see some stimulus dollars, that we allowed the budget on this side to go up There, on our footnote, we had $1 million available for Medicaid to increase those programs. The same amendment was $2 million on the other side. So we have a difference in text, and we have a little bit of difference in the dollar amount. And I think Senator Massey was going to review that some more if you have any questions on it. With respect to the next item on the DD programs, the House had an amendment for the these are the dual diagnosis people. They had their first amendment. Our first amendment was identical to the House amendment. Then we came back with an amended amendment. That was actually the Nicholas amendment that recharacterized how the DD dollars there. So that what we end up is the House has our original amendment, and we had the amended one. We had an amendment for the $375,000 for the senior center employees. That did not pass on the House side. There's the $75,000 to for the antenna removal for public radio. It passed on the House. We did not have a corresponding amendment. The we added a new footnote for the a computerized data management that was for the juvenile matters, once again, no corresponding House amendment. That flips over the backsides, and now we start getting into back sheet, the things that are of greater moment. The first item is that we had in both budgets funded the Pioneer Home and the Girls' School, but we had funded at the JAC level some of that money out of the general fund. What the House did was went into the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund. That's a fund that's generated by revenues from state lands. There's actually a permanent fund and an income fund. It's permanent in the sense that it's there forever, but it's not inviolate in the same type of a sense that our Permanent Mineral Trust Fund is. In 2008, the balance of that the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund. These are royalties generated on state lands that are not earmarked for schools. Those monies first go into the Permanent Land Fund, and then the income off that, 75% goes in the general fund, 25% goes in the Omnibus Land Income Fund. Now, the Omnibus Land Income Fund are dollars that can be spent by the SLIB board without coming to us for prior approval. In 2008, the income fund had a balance of about $5.4 million, so that was all accessible by the SLIB board. We reduced that by $4 million at the JAC to help fund these state projects. Now, these funds, by the way, are designed to support and fund state construction for state facilities. The balance of the land fund in, say, 2000 was $3 million. By 2008, it had reached $22 million. So what the House did is they went in and took $10 million out of the Omnibus Permanent Land Fund. And so with the JAC recs and theirs, the total dollars out are a little in excess of $15 million. So it'll take that balance of $25 million significantly down. Now, when you look at the Goldenrod, and you see that the house is, in essence, profiled about $10 million more than us going into the legislative stabilization reserve account. The reason they're putting $10 million more than us is because they took the funding out of our permanent one-time land fund to fund these buildings. When you fund them, which relieve the general fund obligation for the building, that, in essence, created $10 million more of general fund that flows down in the budget into the legislative stabilization reserve account. So, in effect, I mean, I guess it's a philosophical issue of whether or not you think times are so tough that we have to go into some of our permanent funds to fund buildings in order to create more operating dollars in your rainy day account. Frankly, I don't think it's that rainy out there, and I don't think it's time to, I mean, if the issue is let's go and find out every coffee can we have all the way from the miners' fund to the public buildings of the Capitol to the omnibus land fund to the state hospital, the state training school, permanent, the penitentiary funds, you know, there are a lot of coffee cans out there. So if the idea is to raid coffee cans, then fair enough, but it seems to me that we're not there yet. And I think that the Senate position, which was the JAC position, is a better position. But that's generally the biggest issue with there on those CapCon projects. Then dropping down into the Section 300s, the Senate positions that were not, you don't find on there, we deleted the discretion of the governor to establish a priority under for spending. And the next 302 is the $20,000. This is the FMAP language is a little bit different in our side and on the Senate side, or our Senate side and the House side. With respect to the FMAP positions, everything is changing. I mean, generally, you recall that what we said is, what are we going to do with the $10 million auditor reserve? What are we going to do with the section... the 100 series vacancy dollars that we made available, and then there were the $5 million reversions. We were a little ahead of where the House was as we moved through changes because I think we were having more discussion with the executive branch and what we were going to do. And then after both houses made the decision, the stimulus packages come out. And as with the impact of the stimulus package, I don't think either House has the correct position, and the differences will provide us an opportunity to forge a better package for the Department of Health, and that'll be an easy issue to work through. But generally speaking, the Department of Health first came to us and said, we need for you to eliminate the $20 million auditor reserve because that reserve may disqualify us for the FMAP and some other dollars. So we said, fine, we'll eliminate it. And as soon as they were heard the words eliminate and strike through, they ran out to the oversight folks at Medicaid, and they advised, well, since the reserve was already set up before the stimulus, you can keep it. So, but that's actually convenient because that dollar is actually, or the $20 million is in the original budget, and it would be hard to get into the budget and recharacterize that without an open committee. We have different positions with respect to the $5 million of reversions, and it looks to me like now with the FMAP, they may not need the $5 million reversions at all. And if we simply give them the 100 series flex to use some of those vacancy dollars to operate, that may be enough. So we'll be able to construct that, I think, fairly simply as we move through. So that is the Department of Health differences that I think it's a workout problem, if you will, in light of the new federal stimulus. The Senate third reading, number 19, required an economic analysis for the state health care benefits in comparison to private sector. Refer to JAC. There's no corresponding House position there. We have the On the Senate side, we provided that we coordinate the endowment language in the bill with the endowment language in the budget. If House Bill 155 goes through, no corresponding House position there, not a big deal. Now, when you get into the next one for AML funding for the dynamic compaction, the House first put on a provision in the bill for $2.8 billion for the dynamic compaction. That failed in the Senate. In the House, it first went on. Then it came off in favor of an appropriation for $65,000 to employ an expert to go out and assess the dynamic compaction damages. So we do not have a corresponding position. We'll have to work through that issue. On the next one is the AML funding decreases the on the Uranium Research Center. What we really have, I think, is that once again the House was a step forward. The House position really adopted what I would describe as maybe even the first BBOUT position, and then by the time that the BBOUT amendment modified and improved it, the House hadn't caught up, so I don't think it's going to be a big issue there. When you drop down to the next Senate amendments, we have reversion dates for projects funded with AML monies. Once again, we were looking at some of those issues that the House didn't look at or didn't attend to. On the Reclamation Ecology Project, we recharacterized some of those dollars to go into the Reclamation Ecology Project. No corresponding House position there. Not a big deal. You drop down into the next items. The House Second Reading Amendment number 12, the $3.6 million. What happened there is that many years ago with prior Treasurer's Office, they distributed too much money to cities, towns, and counties through the mineral royalty grant program. So they over-distributed. The error was not caught when the state went to the new accounting system. And with the new accounting system, the transition, it wasn't, you know, the error's been there, and it's finally now caught up to us, and so there is a negative account balance on account of that accounting error of $3.6 million. The effect of that is that there will be no distributions to cities, towns, and counties until that reaches zero. And the treasurer had contacted the chairs of the appropriation committee to say, well, an easy way to take with this is you would allow us to capture reversions to fill up the accounting error, and then we don't have to explain it to anybody, and everybody's good, and the money comes out. The House chair agreed to that request and put the amendment in to capture the $3.6 million from reversions, which are, remember, they're profiled on the green sheet, so it actually reduces your account. Pardon me? That the STDA is the acronym is, it's the Mineral Royalty Grant Program, and all severance tax distribution account, and it's the Mineral Royalty Grant Program for cities, towns, and counties. So we'll have to deal with those issues. You know, it's a dangerous thing, folks, to every time you have a mistake, say, well, let's take reversions out. And reversions are not profiled, so we can take non-profiled income and solve these things. So we'll work through it. The House put on a Wind Energy Select Committee that would require seven members of the Senate to be on it. They had a whole bunch of wind energy programs that they thought were pretty important, and the bills all died. So in order to address those concerns, they have a fairly complicated Wind Energy Select Committee. If you look in your package, it's over on page 9. So you got seven members, so that's 20% of the committee. I think we've already decided what we'll do is they can take all the House members They take the House members, and we'll assign our journal committee person. So the good news is Senator Dockstader is going to have a little extra work. The real problem, though, the good that's the bad news. The good news is all you have to do is take notes. Tell us what they did. So if all of you guys want to be on another select committee, just let us know, I guess. The after the wind energy program, you go down, and the next one is the homeowners property tax system. That's the bill that has gone through the revenue committee. It was reported out of the appropriation committee. That's the homestead tax relief. Now, to fund theirs, what they did is they raided they don't like to use the word raid, but they raided the $37 million that we had saved over time for the Capitol building complex. So you raid those one-time dollars to fund the tax relief. Folks, you know, it seems to me that in the budget process, you have to use judgment and care with respect to what you want to put on as an amendment to the bill. And in any given time, if you take something of this great magnitude and you put it on the bill to make a statement that said, look, this is more important than everything in the budget bill, and we're prepared to vote against the budget bill if we don't get what we want, that's a dangerous precedent to allow. And there comes a time where you simply said that's not an appropriate vehicle to make a major statement. You guys got to put it through committee work, three readings, and it deserves committee work and three readings over here. And if it cannot survive through that process, it shouldn't survive. If it survives, then fair enough, then there's no problem. So I think we'll have some discussion about that. The below that is the $6 million. It's about $9.6 million to Water Account One. Now, once again, we all love Water Account One. Putting more money in Water Account One is not a bad idea. But what has happened here since there's no money profiled and the sponsor couldn't find any way to profile it on the goldenrod, what the sponsor did is went in and appropriated reversions. So the notion is that when reversions come back after the end of the year, and remember we're now profiling reversions from last year, but this would be from this year, what we're going to do is anticipate that some people won't spend all their money. We'll capture those reversions and put them into the account. Once again, it's a bad policy. I think that reversions occur. We know they occur. They're general fund. If it says that next year when we come back, I've already got my priority staked. Before anybody gets to feed at the trough, I get my money first because the money hasn't appeared yet. It's not there yet. But let's decide now that in advance that I get my money first. Really not a good practice to get people into spending or trying to anticipate and spend reversions that don't exist already. The next one is an amendment where the House adopted a Section 300 that directs the governor to go ahead and request the CREG, the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, to meet sometime between now and June, and then if they determine that the there is a shortfall, expenditures over revenues, then go ahead and request. Actually, it doesn't even do that. It says call CREG, and right now go out and ask your agencies to ask for a 5% reduction plan, a 10% reduction plan. Does not tell the governor what to do. And the notion was that we're passing a budget. The agencies may or may not be cooperating with the governor to provide these 5%, 10% reductions. And so let's sort of back him up on that. When I first saw the amendment, my reaction was it's a little silly. The budget already requires the governor to do an amendment an evaluation every 6 months to see whether or not revenues have kept pace with your projections, and if they haven't, or your forecast, if they haven't, then to make adjustments necessary to have a balanced budget. So that's already there. The governor already has that. But and it seemed to me that it's to tell the governor, hey, look, we know these forecasts are messed up. Go ahead and start getting ready to do what you need to do or you may need to do. It's a little bit silly in the sense that we've already given them the tools. And if we really thought there was that big of a problem, we could ask Craig to meet tomorrow or the next day, and then we could take care of it as a legislature. Well, it's not that easy, and it's more complicated, and partly is because these, from the Craig groups, I mean, at any given day, you can ask them to meet, and every given day, they'll give you a different estimate. It's like actuaries. The facts, the numbers change. And it's probably not good practice to bring the Craig group together to meet during the legislative session. And the reason I really believe that is because it leads to potential mischief for if you think, for example, there is that the forecast will go up that day and you want an extra $10 million, you could bring Craig in and say, come in and re-estimate it. Vice versa, if you wanted to use it as a tool to try to reduce spending, you could bring him in. There may be a time under some circumstances to bring him in. And I think as we've talked about it with our representative on the Craig group, and we've talked about, you know, should we be doing it? What should we be doing? Or the consensus of our discussions are it's just not an appropriate thing to do. It's not drastic enough now to bring the Craig group. And even if the Craig group came in and estimated a lower forecasted revenue, we'd still have the same problem, that is, do we pass this budget or not? And what I've discussed to other people, the way I go through the analysis, in my mind's eye, I think if Craig met today, we would lose the forecasted revenue to about $250 million, which is generally the entire carryover surplus that we had planned. But we have a good budget. It's a tight budget. It's about $130 million of spending. The biggest operating dollars in that budget belong to the prison. That's the only major increment that we've increased in terms of operating spending. So if that's the only operating spending, if they have to, that's something that even if we had to go out and reduce our agency budgets, we'd still have to make accommodation for the prison anyway. So it really makes no difference. I mean, we would still say, well, okay, let's reduce everything because we've got to get the prison open eventually. So that leaves the one-time funding, and the one-time funding is principally the joint labs, the biosafety level 3 labs. Those are the big ticket in there. And for the folks that will be here, before, I'm told that once before we funded the biosafety lab to get it out of the Hathaway, and at that time we got a little tight. They rated those dollars, and the price tag now is about 3 times what it could have been built for back then. So there comes a time where you say, well, probably if the decision was between cutting back operating accounts and building the BSL 3 level, 3 labs, we probably ought to get them done. It's time. So, folks, when you're asked the question, well, why don't you just can the budget and walk away when you know, when you have some expectation that the forecast revenues may not materialize, that's the answer. The answer is that we've been very conservative, particularly on the Senate side. We funded the big thing is the prison. The prison dollars are going to have to be shaped into our budget anyway. And the BSL laboratories are very important, and I submit to you that even if we were called upon to have to re-budget with those, we'd find a place to fund them because they just need to get done. So in that sense, it's still prudent, I think, to follow through with the budget that we have. And when I looked at it, I think it's better to move forward with our budget than not to have it. We're better off with the budget, even if the forecasted revenue is coming back. Going back to the issue with the House position on this language, directing the governor and the agencies to give the 5 and 10% reductions, one of the things that's in there that's probably important is the House did say, look, this applies to everybody, and this includes you, the community colleges, you, UW, you, the judiciary. And there has been, and the Department of Education, and there has been discussion among theirs, and we know that's emanating, that people saying, well, wait a minute, doesn't apply to me, you take the pain, I don't have to take the pain. And it seems to me, to the extent that if there's any doubt that any pain that is extracted has to be shared equally, we ought to let people know. Now, by the way, when you go and do these 5 to 10% across the boards, it's pretty draconian to do 5% across the board, just say, look, everybody, cut 5% or 10%. Because if you're the Environmental Quality Council and you only have one staff position and maybe two staff people, cutting out 5 to 10% is much easier than somebody that, an agency like the Department of Health that has enormous vacancies, they've got a lot of things going on. There's a problem in the House amendment because the House says 5 to 10% of your annual or your biennial budget. The governor wasn't asking for that. He's saying, give me 5 to 10% of your fiscal year budget. Huge difference. So we'll have to get that straightened out. Some of the agencies, by the way, as you'll hear them, were proposing to say, well, look, what we'll do is we'll give up our 4% raises and give you back our capital construction budget. And we know why you can't anticipate entirely what the executive branch will do then. The indicators we have is that that's not what the executive branch wants. I mean, you want to get your 4% raises in because you want to maintain competitive salaries. And ultimately, you begin to look at freezing positions, maybe not filling vacancies, tightening up government. We've had a good run of it. We've got some agencies that have grown, and it's a good opportunity to take a look at and streamline ourselves. But you wouldn't want, or from our point of view, I think, as the legislative branch, we don't want the judicial branch out saying, well, we're going to make up our 4% by not giving wage increases, but the Attorney General's office gets wage increases. So then we get come back a year and a half from now, and the judiciary comes and says, well, we need 8% now to catch up with the folks over in the Attorney General's office. So whatever happens, we need to have a uniform plan, and it'll be, I mean, that's, if it happens, it happens. I'm sure the governor will keep us advised, and it's just part of life. The next item is the $100 million. This is the PMTF diversion. We put in a statute that you call there's a discretionary 1% of the severance taxes that flows into the permanent mineral trust fund. The House recommended that we intercept those dollars before they reach the permanent mineral trust fund and put them into the spending policy, into the LISRA, the Legislative Stabilization Reserve Account, in order to have more money to beef up the operating fund. And it's a tough issue, but my view of it is we put that money in. We're not at – it is not – we're not at the point now where we need to cry the sky is falling. We're still in pretty good position. We still have a $3.5 billion budget. There's about $1 billion worth of one-time expenditures, capital construction, highway construction, an enormous amount of things there. It seems to me that and if you go back to the last time we took that diversion out in the 80s, we were far, far from where we are now. I mean, we're simply not at at that point. But once that's an area where there are some things that you have to compromise, and I assume that that's one where we probably should compromise with them. The next amendment is the Recovery Act amendments, and that's the amendments that the House put on, where we created what people now are calling the LISA account, the legislative account to capture all of the stimulus dollars. Mechanically, it doesn't look like that count is really going to work the way we thought it might at the beginning. There are provisions in that amendment that are worth salvaging, but since the House doesn't have that position, there's an opportunity to develop a better amendment that better addresses where we're going. And I think where we're probably going is that these dollars are not earmarked to the state of Wyoming where we can capture them and redistribute them. They're devoted to the Department of Health that will capture some that go to the highway departments and goes directly. But we do have an interest in making sure that they're accounted for and that they're utilized in a way that's consistent with at least the chief executive officer believes is appropriate. So in the end, I hope that we walk out with an amendment that says that all applications for these dollars, any expenditure of the dollars, have to be subject to review and consent by the governor, so that we have the governor's office at least being the policeman with respect to what we're applying for and whether it's appropriate. There are provisions in that amendment that says they don't, any dollars that you receive do not get built into your standard budget. That's still a good provision. So that's an easy one to compromise. On balance, Mr. President, while last Friday it may have looked like we were far apart, once we addressed the issue of the homestead tax, it's a pretty easy thing to work through. Thank you.
Questions or discussions? Senator Coe.
Diversion, and I understand that's a diversion.
Can you say that again?
It's a diversion or it's an interception. The $100 million is an interception of the normal flow, correct?
Correct. It's an interception.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, under Article 15, Section 19, you know, I can read the whole thing, but it says the mineral subject to such excise tax will be coal, petroleum, natural gas, oil, shale, and such other minerals as may be designated by the legislature. Such tax shall, in addition to any other excise, severance, ad valorem tax, the proceeds from such tax shall be deposited in the Permanent Wyoming Mineral Trust Fund. My comments are, do we have a right constitutionally to intercept or divert those funds?
Senator Nicholas.
Mr. President, the answer to this particular stream is yes. We have a constitutional diversion that goes to the PMTF, and we have a statutory 1%. And I guess for those that haven't been around, when things were good in the early 80s, this legislature diverted an additional 1% severance tax into the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund. By the mid-90s, when things got bad, we needed that money, so we undid that statutory diversion. And about 2 years ago, through a bill that Senator Schiffer put together, we put that statutory diversion back into the PMTF. So we have that 1% statutory diversion. It generates approximately $120 million a year that we put in on an optional basis into the Permanent Mineral Trust Fund, $220 million for the biennium. And it is our option, and because it's a statutory diversion, we would have the authority through the budget to stop that diversion, intercept them, if you will, much like we intercepted the money, the federal mineral royalties, before they were going into the school foundation program account to fund the Hathaway program. So you can intercept them, if you will, divert them into the account. The philosophically, the question is it's such a rainy day now that it's time to stop that additional savings? And frankly, I don't think it is. I don't think it is. Partly, I see that revenues are going down. But again, when we started this run, folks, we were at a $2 billion budget. We're at a huge budget compared to there. We're a long ways away from there. And we've got a lot of one-time things. If this trend continues, maybe it's something we continue. Having said that, this is one of those provisions where you don't get everything you want. We'll be bargaining on that, and we'll give them a little bit, and they're not going to get everything they want, and we're not going to get everything that we wanted.
Senator Vivaldi.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. on the proposed expansion of the Capitol building, how much money is in the 08 budget that we passed and then the supplemental budget as it now stands to set aside to build that if that's what the state decides to do in terms of total dollars?
Before Senator Nicholas, I might say we're on the third reading and our regular rules apply, except that I have ruled that the chairman of the Appropriation Committee is not limited because he needs to answer our question. Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, there's a total of $37 million that have accumulated in what we call the Capital Complex Renovation Account. Of that $37 million, $10 million was added to under the budget that we're working under right now. $27 million was put in prior accounts, so it is in was already arrived in the account and it's sitting in the account. The distinction is significant in this sense. The governor, if he declares that there's an emergency, has the ability to divert or not spend, not to divert, but he has the authority to go in and reduce spending in a variety of counts, anything that's in the budget. So the governor could, if he wanted under the 08 budget, reduce spending by $10 million to that account. If he did that, then the $10 million would flow into the LSRA the way our account works. He can't spend it, but it moves into that operational account. My assumption is he's probably not going to do that, so that's the distinction there. So $27 million was developed and put into an account called the Capital Renovation Account, Capital Complex Renovation. Before this budget, $10 million was added. Those dollars then arrive into an account for the Capital Complex Renovation. It was former Senator Mockler that was really the advocate for those dollars, and the strong advocacy was that this building is going to need a substantial renovation to put in sprinkler systems, things like that. It's our crown jewel. It needs work, and it's there. We had made earlier discussions about maybe using some of those dollars next year to build the state office building rather than keep it here. But anyway, it's a coffee can there. There is another budget in the item in the budget for the level 3 study for the Capitol complex or for the state office building. That is in both budgets. The only difference is that we added the legislative members for the exterior review. That's not on the House side.
Senator Burns.
Mr. President, in the presentation, one of the items that was skipped over is the fourth from the top on the cheat sheet, which is a third reading, Senate third reading, Amendment 25, which creates the State Office Building Exterior Legislative Oversight Committee. I thought we had killed that, Gummer.
Senator Nicholas.
President, what we did is we killed the amendment that sounded like a fine wine. The fine wine amendment went down. What was adopted was a legislative oversight committee composed of members from both houses simply to look and to approve what the final exterior is. The fine wine went down.
Senator Vasey.
Yes, Mr. President. Going down to that reversion from the water account, and a little explanation. I guess my concern there is that this is, to me, is a fairly dangerous diversion of that money. Those reversions, there's a level of trust among the applicants anymore that says, you know, that if we're not going to need all this money, if we're not ready for this project, we'll revert that back to, so it can work within that water to develop. But if we start, to me, that's a stealing of that, not stealing, but misappropriate. So.
Senator Nicholas.
President, and if I did not explain it well, it's actually an amendment you might like. What the reversions we're talking about are general government reversions. So, for example, if the Department of Health does not spend all of their appropriated dollars at the end of the fiscal year, then anything not spent reverts to the general fund. What this does is capture a percentage of those reversions and then diverts them into the water account. What I was saying is that, in effect, what that means is that we know that in our budget we're going to have a certain amount of reversions, and it's a mechanism to say, look, before you guys get to feed at that trough, let's decide today, a year in advance, that it's going to go into Water 1, which I think is bad policy, because if we get in the practice of doing that, we're going to have a whole bunch of amendments to say, well, let me get it in first in line next year. So it's bad policy, but not for the reasons. This is not talking about your reversions within the expenditure count.
Further discussions? There being no further discussion on House Bill 1, in accordance with Joint Rule 14-1, little g, and Joint Rule 14-1, little h, 1 and 2, House Bill 1, is referred directly to a conference committee of 5 members from each House to meet to resolve the differences between the Houses with respect to both budget bills, Senate File 1 and House Bill 1. The conference committee will be Nicholas, Chairman, Myers, Massey, Peterson, and Townsend. I will also appoint the conference committee for message 412, which was House Bill 287, helium petroleum property tax, and that will be Schiffer, Chair, Bebout, and Martin. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, I move that the Senate adjourn until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
Okay. Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. House Bill 239 engrossed, which was read in a little bit ago, contains an appropriation, and I would like to re-refer it to committee number 2.
House Bill
239
will be re-referred to committee with number 2, appropriations without objections. Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, Water Resources, tomorrow at Friday at noon, we'll have a telephone conversation with William B. Rezer. He's being appointed to the Water Development Commission. And then tomorrow night, Thursday, February 26th, the Select Water Committee will have a meeting up in F-15.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number 4, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, or a little bit before if we can, in S-11. To do Senate interviews with confirmations, Larry Atwell, Wyoming Community College Commission, Charlene Bodine, Wyoming Community College Commission, Wendy Sweeney, Wyoming Community College Commission, Michael Shidmanic, Board of Education, Noreen Kasparvik, something like that, Board of Education, Philip Orton, Board of Education, Gerald Joe Riekert, Board of Education, and Bradford Mead, University of Wyoming Board of Trustees.
Senator Von Platerman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highway, and Military Affairs, will meet in 10 minutes in S-13 to review House Bill 191 engrossed motor carrier transportation contracts and to discuss interim topics.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Corporations Committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, got a little bit of the change up in the schedule, so I need the members to pay attention. Mr. President, because we're coming in early tomorrow at 9 o'clock, we're still going to meet in House 18 at 8 a.m. to have an informal discussion with the Public Service Commission and to discuss interim topics. That'll last 1 hour. And then I've had to call another meeting, Mr. President, and it'll be Friday morning at 8 o'clock up in S-19 to do confirmation hearings on 3 individuals, Almanier, who's appointed to the Public Service Commission, and Dixie C., who's appointed to the Real Estate Commission. We're going to do that one via telephone. and George Bo Short, Jr., who's also appointed to the Real Estate Commission. That'll be Friday at 8 a.m. on this side.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Senate Committee Number 2 Appropriations is going to meet in a new office that we've commandeered upstairs, S-14, upon adjournment to consider House Bill 146 and Gross Emergency Medical Services Sustainability Trust, House Bill 294 and Gross Prescription Drug Database, and we'll also consider Senator Peterson's House Bill 239, Bighorn Basin Discovery Center.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. The Conference Committee on Senate File 103, Child Abuse and Neglect Amendments, will meet tomorrow at noon, and then hopefully shortly thereafter, the Conference Committee on Senate File 67, Sex Offender Registration, will meet. Both of these will be in the House Judiciary Committee room.
Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. President. I was so taken back by that last bill of the Bighorn Basin that I forgot to announce. We're also going to meet tomorrow at 8 a.m. in S-13 to consider House Bill 299, School Facilities Budget Process.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 9 will meet at 8:30 a.m. Friday in room 302. Room 302 for teleconferencing to conduct a hearing on the governor's nomination of Sandy Shruptine to the position of Industrial Siting Council, Tom Waterhouse, the position of State Mining Council, Bern Hinckley to the position of Enhanced and Improved Oil Recovery Commission, Fred Ogden to the position of Environmental Quality Council, Christopher Mullen to the position of Geological Survey Board, Catherine Gashewski to the position of the Environmental Quality Council, and Maha Masharin, or something like that, to the position of the University of Wyoming Energy Resources Council. And
Senator Larson.
The same committee number 9 will meet with the House Minerals Committee on Friday on the noon adjournment in H-18 over in the House to consider interim committee topics.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. President, Revenue Committee number 3 will meet tomorrow, Thursday, February 26, 30 minutes after noon recess in S-16. We'll go over interim topics, and we'll work House Bill 186 engrossed, gasoline tax, agriculture exemption 2, House Bill 230 engrossed, vehicle sales and use tax number 2, and House Bill 50, tax sales costs. Mr. President, your committee number 3 will meet on Friday, February 27th, upon noon recess in House 11. That's the big room over there, to meet with our counterparts at the other end of the building to talk about interim topics.
Senator Burns.
President, the Joint Travel Committee will meet over in House 11, H-11, to discuss interim topics and, I guess, decorate the room for when Revenue meets there Friday, and in about 10 minutes, exactly 10 minutes from now. And also tomorrow at 20 minutes after the noon recess, we will be meeting up in S-14 to interview the governor's nominees. The following nominees: Mary Hawkins to the position on State Parks and Cultural Resources Commission, Peggy Colson to the position of Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust Account Board, and Aaron Clark and Michael Healy to the Game and Fish Commission.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. And just quickly, Mr. President, I just want to thank the body for their patience and forbearance as we kind of jockey time and manipulate bills and whatnot, but reason being is not necessarily so that we can do more bills, but I think the Senate has a reputation for doing quality work, and we're trying to put you in a position to do your very best work, try to allow you to take the time that you need to ask those questions and that you need in order to have a quality debate. We are coming in again early tomorrow. I don't really know in regard to the adjournment. but I will tell you that we're not going to make any time adjustments on Friday. We're going to start on 10, and we're going to end at a reasonable time. And when we're done, we will have said that we will have done a quality job. Thank you.
You've heard the motion that the Senate stand adjourned until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, Thursday, February 26th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned.